You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Maria Santelli. She is the executive director of the Center on Conscience and War, two things that you might not imagine go together, a 75-year-old organization founded to provide technical and community support to conscientious objectors to war. Based in Washington, D.C., Santelli has been working for peace and justice since 1996. You may want to check out the website of the Center on Conscience and War. It is found at centeronconscience.org, and you can find out your rights as a member of the military in any capacity, or a possible prospective member of the military, or anyone else. Call 1-800-379-2679 or check out centeronconscience.org. Maria also has a couple of excellent articles just published on truthout.org that we may be talking about. Maria, we are sort of in wartime, sort of in peacetime. There's no draft. What is the relevance of conscientious objection right now?
Well, I would say we are definitely in wartime, especially looking at what just happened this weekend. I can't let this discussion go by without mentioning the sickening events in Afghanistan on Saturday when the United States bombed the hospital, the Doctors Without Borders hospital in Kunduz. Not only bombed it, but bombed it for a sustained 30 minutes when there were no reported firefights in the vicinity and when the United States long had the exact coordinates and the hospital was well marked. And this is just a disgusting event. I should be celebrating with my organization 75 years of supporting those who follow the counsel of their conscience and resist war. But I can't celebrate because I'm made sick by what war is. And this indiscriminate violence is war. It defines war. It characterizes war, every war. And so as I think about the suffering of those who are already wounded or sick and were in a hospital, because of the work that I do, I also think of those members of the U.S. military who were part of that bombing. And many of them are going to shake it off for at least the time being. But many of them will feel eventually, and many of them will feel immediately, the consequences of those actions. They will understand this was not a mistake. This is just war. This is what war is. And for them, for many of them, this moment will crystallize their conscience, and they will urgently need a way out. They'll need a way to follow their conscience and separate themselves from the United States military and from their participation in war. And at that time, the Center on Conscience and War will be there for them, as we have been for conscientious objectors for 75 years. And we will help them follow the legal pathway that is available to them to be able to walk away from the United States military and become part of the larger movement for peace and justice.
And what is that legal pathway? What can they do to get out? What action should someone take who has figured out once they're in the military that they're engaged in something evil?
Well, so as you mentioned, without a draft, what does this look like? So, of course, in the draft days, when our organization, the Center on Conscience and War, was founded in 1940, there was a draft. So our work was to keep men of conscience, it was only men, out of the military and provide them with alternative service. It wasn't that they didn't want to serve, they just didn't want to kill people. So we helped to provide them with alternative service, helped them craft their statements of conscience to not be drafted, to not be compelled to kill other people. So in 1962, there was still an active draft going on, but the Pentagon actually realized that there are going to be people who were either already drafted or perhaps maybe joined voluntarily, but have a crisis of conscience and realize once they get in there that they cannot do this. They cannot, in good conscience, actively take part or even passively take part in war and war making. And so since that time, since 1962, there has been a process by which members of the military can apply for discharge. There is DOD. They call it DOD, Department of Defense Personnel Policy. But there are, each branch has its own regulations on how to apply for discharge as a conscientious objector. So when people realize that they can no longer take part in war making, they can obviously give us a call and we'll provide them with all of the support that they need, or they can, you know, download these regulations themselves and make their application. They have three legal burdens to meet. They have to prove that they are opposed to their participation in war in any form. They have to prove that these beliefs developed after they joined, after they enlisted, after they commissioned, whatever their particular case may be. So people say, well, you know, didn't they know what they were getting into? Well, you know, not to say that these people didn't have some responsibility, but of course they didn't really realize what they were getting into. We're sold such a heap of goods, you know, about what military service is, what war is, that a lot of times young people, they haven't thought about it at all, or they've been grossly misled when they join the military. So that's part of their burden. They have to prove that they are someone different, that when they joined the military, maybe they thought it was a necessary evil. Maybe they thought they were going to be getting the bad guys. They didn't think they were going to be bombing hospitals in Kunduz, Afghanistan. And then the third legal burden that they have is that they have to show that their conscience, these beliefs, are a controlling force in their life. In other words, they cannot live with themselves if they continue on this path of war. And so we help them craft applications that will enable them to follow their conscience.
Maria, you mentioned that some people might look at an incident like bombing a hospital and burning the patients to death and say, well, that was just one accident in an otherwise admirable mission that's a necessary evil and so forth. It seems to me a lot of people are going to take one step further and say, oh, well, this particular war is mistaken and misguided, and other wars are good and justifiable. And that apparently doesn't count, doesn't register with Department of so-called defense policy. They have to go a third step and get to the understanding that, in fact, the entire institution of war is evil. And that's extremely hard to get even peace activists to that point. How many people sort of get stuck? They haven't quite gone far enough in their understanding to actually qualify to conscientiously object.
Well, that's the real power of this process. I mean, how many of us, especially, you know, people listening to this program, people who are Pacifica listeners specifically, really know their own hearts, they think. We think we know our own hearts. We think we know our own conscience. But how many of us have actually gone through that exercise of writing down what it is that you believe, your values, your moral framework, what tells you what is right and what is wrong? Not only do you write that down, you trace its evolution, how you came to develop those beliefs, and then you prove through example how you live those beliefs in your life. That's what these members of the military have to do. How many of us have ever performed that exercise? It's a real worthwhile one. I would recommend people, you know, give it a try. It's very difficult, but it really, it helps you understand your own motivations, your own soul, your own heart. And oftentimes in that process, you come to that place. When you do that kind of analysis of your values and how they relate to war, how those values tell you that this war might be wrong, because that's where people are coming from. Your objection by law can't be political. But, of course, everybody is coming from a particular political space in time. That's your frame of reference. Your frame of reference is you were in Iraq, or your frame of reference is you were in Afghanistan, or you played some kind of support role for this war making in 2015, in this modern time. But that is a place that people will springboard from to realize, no, all war is wrong. This isn't just something that, this isn't an isolated incident. This isn't just something that happened today. This isn't just something that happened with this kind of technology. They get to that place where they realize when they really dig deep and pull back all those layers and reveal their core values, they realize that they cannot reconcile their conscience with any war.
I wish more people would get to that point, of course, as you do. But, you know, this week, not only did the United States blow up a hospital in Afghanistan, and all of my friends and peace activists who've been saying stop bombing Afghanistan for 14 years kept saying it, but also Russia started bombing Syria. And peace activists who have not only gone through writing down their beliefs, but have sat in police vans with me and gone to jail for their beliefs and resisted military funding and preparations for war, as well as particular wars, started cheering for Russian bombs in Syria, because somehow that will bring law and order and oppose the U.S. bombing in Syria. Now, shouldn't we be supporting conscientious objection among the Russians in the military as well? Isn't that what Tolstoy would have done? Or you know, somehow do people think they oppose all wars and they don't really? There comes along a different aspect and now it's okay.
Absolutely, we should be supporting conscientious objectors. How can we ask someone, if you're a peace activist and you've taken your body, you've either by active decision or by default taken your body out of participation in war? A lot of people have resisted taxes, I think you just alluded to, so that they take their dollars actively out of the act of war. But then you would allow someone else's body, someone else's dollars to do what you yourself have said no, you cannot do. That doesn't seem like it's a very fair decision to make, or a very fair position to hold, because there are going to be consequences, not just for the people who are burned alive in their beds because they can't escape, for the people who lose limbs, but for the people who carry out the war. We have decades and decades and generations of people that we know of, that are our family members, that are our community members, who suffer the tragic consequences of war, even the good war. How many people have a grandpa who never talked about the war? He was in the good war, the World War II. That was the good war, but he never talked about it, or he had a drinking problem. Tens of thousands of people resisted World War II, the good war. There are volumes written about why that was not a good war. Quakers, who founded our organization, were among the groups that founded our organization, refused to fight, but that didn't mean that they weren't putting their bodies on the line in some other way. I have a dear friend whose name some people may recognize, Dory Bunting. She's a Quaker. She's in her 90s. In 1939, her Quaker parents sent her to do solidarity with the Jews in Germany. These people were not afraid of confrontation. They weren't afraid of nonviolent conflict to solve problems. They put their bodies on the line, but they knew that war was not going to solve anything. How is war going to continue to solve any of the problems in Afghanistan or in Syria or with ISIS? War created those problems. War is at the heart, and so it can never be the solution.
Is World War II, Maria Santelli of Center on Conscience and War, is World War II still predominantly the package of myths that lead to people resisting the idea that all war is wrong? I mean, it seems to me, you know, despite all the missteps from the ending of World War I forward that led unnecessarily to World War II, and all of the evil of World War II that made war about killing civilians, and the absolute irrelevance of the killing of the Jews and others in the camps, which had nothing to do with U.S. motivations in World War II, it seems to me that for the entire existence of your organization, for 75 years, people have been saying, well, this war is bad, but World War II was good, so I can't oppose all war. Is World War II really the problem in terms of education?
It still is. I was just at a hearing down at Dahlgren Naval Base in Virginia on September 24th. One of our Navy conscientious objectors and his investigating officer asked him, come on, really? What about World War II? What do you think we should have done there? Do you think we should have just allowed that slaughter of millions of people? And yes, it is absolutely still held up and even, you know, tossed out into conscientious objectors' faces. Of course, now we add to that, well, what about 9/11? Shouldn't we couldn't have retaliated. We shouldn't have sought justice for 9/11. Also, we now hear about ISIS, of course. One of our Air Force officers that we worked with is a Christian. Now, again, the modern definition of conscientious objection, back in 1940 when we started, you could only be a religious objector. Your objection could only be based on your religion. Now we have folks who the law has opened up over the last 75 years through court challenges, and an atheist can be a conscientious objector. A Buddhist, obviously, an agnostic, any moral or ethical objection to war counts legally as a conscientious objector. But this particular Air Force officer was a Christian, and his conscience crystallized when the Christians were held by ISIS and under siege last summer, 2014, and were being exterminated in great numbers. And he searched his heart, and as a Christian, he thought, do I believe in using war to save other Christians? And when his own answer was no, I cannot support war, even to save a minority of Christians in this community, that is when he knew he had to seek a separation from the military. I think people, you know, I think our conscience tells us, if we take the time to search, our conscience will tell us that war is wrong, that war is only going to lead to more war. How can the United States, especially now with what just happened on Saturday, how can the United States build any more trust of the people of Afghanistan? How can the United States actually be the partner with the Afghan government to get rid of the Taliban or to unify the people of Afghanistan? How can we do that when this is our tactic, when war only serves to divide?
Indeed, it brings more war, and it created that danger to those Christians. It didn't arise out of nowhere. It arose out of past wars. What if you're not in the military? What if you're not paying taxes? What if you're just turning 18 and you're supposed to register, at least if you're male, right? You're supposed to register for the draft. Should you do that?
Well, that's an individual matter of conscience, and we support people who make any choice. It's pretty devastating. I mean, people think, oh, a draft is never coming back. Well, probably not. A draft probably does not have the popular support in this country to actually become reality. But one of the roles of our organization, especially being based in Washington, D.C., is that we monitor what's going on with the Selective Service System, a $26 million organization, by the way, who has a dual mission, and the mission is supposed to be equal. Both sides of the mission are supposed to be equal. The first is to provide personnel to the DOD. Provide bodies to the war machine. That's half of the Selective Service System's mission. The other half is to provide for the conscientious objector community in time of war. That means that they provide alternative civilian service for conscientious objectors, and that's a victory that our organization won 75 years ago, because before that, in World War I, conscientious objectors were forced to do non-combat military service, so they still were part of the war machine. So today, a young man may still have reservations. Just putting his name on a piece of paper, just getting on that list to be provided to the DOD, to be personnel that the Selective Service provides to the DOD, that in and of itself can be a violation of conscience for the young man. Because outside of an active draft, the Selective Service does not register conscientious objectors. That's good and bad. It's unfortunate for people for whom, you know, it is a violation of their conscience to register. But it's okay, because it puts everybody on an even playing field. You know, maybe you didn't know what conscientious objection was, and so you didn't register as a conscientious objector. And then in the event of a draft, you're not at a disadvantage from someone who was raised with that vernacular and with that identity. So for a young man who it is a violation of their conscience to register, we have a loan program that young men can apply to help them finance college, because, of course, they are cut out of many of the benefits of citizenship simply for resisting putting their name on that line. But it's becoming less and less of an issue, because there are these laws that we have on the books in some 40 states plus the District of Columbia that actually associate your driver's license or your state ID with registering for the draft. And so a young man, in many cases, does not even have the opportunity to exercise his conscience. He doesn't have the opportunity, as the law says, to present himself. He is indeed presented by his Department of Motor Vehicles to the Selective Service Department. So the government has seen that when given a choice, young men will resist putting their name on this list. We saw in the 80s some young men being prosecuted, and they got to tell their story for not registering. They got to tell their story on the evening news. And to the government's surprise, the sympathy was with the resistors. And so that sort of, for lack of a better word, that sort of backfired in the government's face. So they no longer prosecute young men who choose not to register, but they cut them out of these benefits of citizenship, having never been prosecuted, let alone convicted, of any crime. You will be deprived of financial aid from the federal government and from some state governments and from some institutions of higher education, and you'll also be deprived in many states of the ability to obtain a driver's license or state-issued ID.
And you say, Maria, you say in some 40 states they just automatically, when they've got your information at the DMV or whatever, they automatically register you for the draft. I think we're at 2 states now that automatically register you to vote. So you can see where the priorities are in the U.S. government. Go kill people in the name of democracy is significantly more prioritized than actual democracy. I think in these recent wars, the U.S. military has seen a lot more people just desert than go through trying to conscientiously object. Which is better?
Well, it's tough. I mean, there's no question about it. It's a long process to legally seek discharge. It takes, at the very, very minimum, it will take 5 months. And that's if everybody does everything they should exactly at the time that they should do it. But that's rare, as you can imagine, because we're talking about the military. People think, oh, the military is very regimented. Everything's very efficient. That couldn't be further from the truth. There's a lot of sloppiness. There's a lot of laziness. And there's just a lot of dragging of feet in the military. In addition to that, conscientious objection is not a priority for the Department of Defense, as you can imagine. And so people end up spending a lot of time waiting. They are protected to some extent once they submit, once they declare themselves a conscientious objector. The DOD policy does say that they are to be given duties that conflict as little as possible with their stated beliefs. That means they're not going to be, you know, required to train with weapons or to fire weapons and things like that. But, of course, every job in the military supports the ability for for the military to make war. That's what it's for. That's what it exists for. So it is hard. It's hard for people to endure several months of waiting while their claim is pending. But we see an incredible effect, a transformative effect, just declaring oneself a conscientious objector, just taking that proactive step and saying, no, I'm going to reclaim my conscience, I'm going to reclaim my life, and I'm not going to be part of this anymore. And that does often, most times, give them the strength to endure. And for a lot of people, that is important, that they're recognized as conscientious objectors, that it goes up to, in every branch, it goes to the level, to the highest levels of that chain of command in each branch, to the headquarters level. That's where the conscientious objection decision is made. So that's very important for a lot of people. For others, they have to remove themselves immediately. It is a matter of some quite literally sometimes life and death, and they have to take themselves out of the situation immediately. In that case, of course, we're there to stand by them as well. You know, I mean, it's that they're no less conscientious objectors just because they might have chosen to discharge themselves. Informally, we say. I'm not going to pass judgment on anyone based on whatever they've needed to do personally to obey the highest law, which is their own conscience.
In one of your recent articles on truthout.org, you say that conscience is contagious. So when people conscientiously object, does that really start a trend? Do you see others conscientiously objecting? Does it make a difference for people to sort of openly take a stand and take a risk for resisting participation?
Absolutely, it does. does. We are busier. I mean, we've really tried. We've been really going out of our way to make sure people know that this is an option, that you don't have, you know, too many times in the military people feel like they have two options, obey your conscience or obey your orders. And a lot of times those two are not the same thing. And we want to make sure people know there is a third choice, and that choice is conscientious objection. And we've tried really hard in the last several years to make sure people know that. And we've seen the fruits of our labor. We've seen our caseload of conscientious objectors skyrocketing. We couldn't be more thrilled. We're really busy, but we couldn't be more thrilled. And the DOD has noticed this as well, and we're concerned about this because we see some shenanigans, for lack of a better word, going on that we're not happy with, and we've actually just initiated a congressional inquiry through conscientious objector Congressman John Lewis of Atlanta, through his office. He's initiated a congressional inquiry into all four branches to see what's going on. But I've spoken personally with a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps who said, we're really swamped with conscientious objectors right now. And he was, you know, mad about it. And I said, well, yeah, you don't have to tell me because I'm sending them to you. You know, so they see a rise as well, and they don't like it. So we see it's bad for morale. It's you know, a lot of times when people submit their applications, their commands will try to bargain with them, make deals with them, try to keep it quiet, you know, try to get them out some other way. In fact, they're instructed, if there are other ways to get this person out besides conscientious objection, do it. Because if the application proceeds, it compels this conversation around the unit and up the levels of the chain of command. It compels this conversation about the morality of war. And we hear over and over again people's commanders saying to them, I support you. I wish I could do it too, but I have, you know, this such and such excuse or that such and such excuse, or I'm this far from retirement. And they're actually quite sympathetic. It is the rare case where someone is ridiculed or ostracized. It is actually the rare case. Most people are supported, or at worst, they're tolerated as their application is progressing.
Well, it may be bad for morale, but I have to assume it's good for survival rates, looking at the suicide rate among veterans is so disproportionately higher than for non-veterans. Those who go through a process of returning to a law-abiding, non-violent existence must have higher survival rates. We're just about out of time. Maria Santelli from the Center on Conscience and War, where can people go to get involved? What can they do to help you?
Well, visit centeronconscience.org, of course, and then, as you mentioned, the 800 number, which I don't know off the top of my head.
I've got it. call 800-379-2679.
We're on Facebook, Center on Conscience and War. We're on Twitter. Tell everyone that you know that conscientious objection is real, it is alive and well, it is possible. This myth persists that it's impossible, nobody ever wins. We win all the time, and we help conscientious objectors win and get their discharge. And as you mentioned, it is a safer path. It is a healthier path. We see this trauma that members of the military are experiencing now, and we understand it to be moral injury, which is translated as a transgression against the conscience. And we find conscientious objection can be a powerful tool in both preventing and healing moral injury.
Maria Santelli, thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much, David. Take care.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Countersmith.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, a Maine mayor calls for publishing the names and addresses of anyone receiving public assistance, which he calls the albatross around the state's neck. That's ugly, clearly, and illegal, probably. But somehow the growing number of people, many with jobs, relying on some form of aid isn't enough to shake the notion that economic need is something you can shame people out of. Helping to develop a forceful counter-narrative is Rebecca Vallis, Director of Policy for the Poverty to Prosperity Program at the Center for American Progress and co-host of Talk Poverty Radio. She'll join us to talk about that. Also on the show, the EPA was set to announce tighter standards on smog, which scientists say is necessary to lessen harms to public health. It's no surprise that polluting industries disapprove, so why do media just recite their protests without interrogating them? We'll hear from David Barron of the group Earth Justice on that issue. That's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press. The September 29th Washington Post referred to Republican presidential candidate Carly Fiorina's reference in the recent debate to video depicting Planned Parenthood staffers discussing harvesting the brain of a fully formed fetus. It's widely agreed that the videos put out by the Anti-Choice Center for Medical Progress were deceptively produced and edited, and what Fiorina says she saw isn't in them. Here's how the Post sums it up. Quote, on the facts, Carly Fiorina has been proved wrong. But on the politics, her impassioned condemnation of a Planned Parenthood video has turned her into a champion of the anti-abortion movement and given her outsider candidacy new momentum. Close quote. It's bad enough that the Post didn't fact-check Fiorina's claim immediately. The paper's day-after coverage stated that the brain-harvesting scene, quote, is described by a Planned Parenthood technician in the third episode of secretly recorded interviews by the Center for Medical Progress, an anti-abortion group, close quote. After the facts were made clear, for the paper to background a candidate's lie in favor of attention to the lie's political impact, pretty much defines being part of the problem. Consortium News' Joe Loria reported stunned silence in the UN General Assembly September 28th as Barack Obama warned leaders against regressing to the pre-United Nations era in which strong nations imposed their will by force against the weak, calling out Russia and China in particular. Seeing as the U.S. has led and participated in coups in Iran and Guatemala, invasions of Vietnam and Iraq, and the overthrow of democracies to install monarchies or dictatorships, such as Mobutu in Congo, Suharto in Indonesia, and Pinochet in Chile, to hear Obama say, quote, we see some major powers assert themselves in ways that contravene international law, close quote, was, for many people, bizarre. That sort of thing doesn't faze elite media, though. A New York Times story by Michael Gordon on the 27th, for instance, contained this line on the Syrian conflict. Quote, even as the United States has banked on a diplomatic strategy of trying to enlist Russia's cooperation in Syria, the Kremlin has continued to jolt the White House with its unilateral military and political moves, close quote. Well, the U.S. strategy involves getting Russia to endorse regime change in Syria, while the U.S. carries on a campaign that has so far involved facilitating the shipment of at least 160 plane loads of weapons to rebels trying to bring down the government of Bashar al-Assad, as the Times itself has reported. It's included the CIA spending $1 billion to train fighters to overthrow the government, as we learned from the Washington Post, along with some 5,000 airstrikes in Syria and Iraq, mainly against the violent movement known as ISIS, but the U.S. has declared that it will use air power to support anti-government forces. That bombing has so far killed at least 584 non-combatant civilians. But the Times contrasts this with Russia's unilateral military and political moves. The prime example is Russia's bid to expand its political and military influence by, quote, reaching an understanding with Iraq, Syria, and Iran to share intelligence about the Islamic State, close quote. In other words, Russia agreed to share information with three internationally recognized governments about an openly genocidal militant group that has seized territory in two of those governments' countries. Why is that unilateral? Because, Gordon explains, it was done, quote, without notice to the United States, close quote. An earlier Times report said Russia's deployment of planes to an airbase in Syria, quote, appears to leave little doubt about Moscow's goal to establish a military outpost in the Middle East, close quote. If that's nefarious, the U.S. has a lot of explaining to do, given that this country has more than 50 major bases in the region. But by the Times standards, that doesn't constitute unilateral military expansion, presumably because, by definition, Washington is always kept informed. And finally, September 27th through October 3rd is Banned Books Week, a project of the National Coalition Against Censorship. But the whole thing's silly because no one even bans books anymore, right? That was the upshot of Banned Books Week is a Crock, a September 28th Slate piece by Ruth Graham, reprinted in the Dallas Morning News and elsewhere. Graham argued that Banned Books Week, quote, traffics in fear-mongering over censorship, when in fact the truth is much sunnier. There is basically no such thing as a banned book in the United States in 2015, close quote. Well, Graham is correct that there's a distinction between banning a book and filing a challenge to remove a work from a school library, a classroom, or a summer reading list. The latter, she argues, is, quote, part of a reasonable local conversation about public education, close quote, and parents have a right to weigh in on what their children read in school. But as the coalition's communications director and FAIR alum Peter Hart writes, there's no serious argument that a parent should have no such rights. Parents have the right to express an opinion and even to ask for an alternative assignment for their child. But that parent has no right to determine what other students, the children of other parents, can read in class or in a school library. And that is the goal of most book challenges. Even when a book challenge fails, it may still result in the removal of a book, sometimes temporarily, sometimes not. Graham thinks several hundred cases a year shouldn't inspire hand-wringing. But those are conservative estimates. The American Library Association thinks as many as 80% of challenges go unreported. And what about school officials who steer clear of controversy by avoiding potentially controversial books altogether? Self-censorship, as the School Library Journal put it, is a dirty secret that no one in the profession wants to talk about. More, as Hart notes, we should consider the impact of book challenges beyond the world of books. They are part of a larger cultural battle over the control over what kids see, learn, and create. The point of Banned Books Week is that to be thoughtful, mature, and informed, young people need the freedom to explore the world in all its complexity. The same could be said for grown-ups. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. A mayor in Maine suggests publishing the names and addresses of anyone receiving public assistance so people can see how their money is being spent. Part of the problem, said Lewiston's Robert McDonald, is that the state's schools attract too many special education students. And, well, you know what freeloaders they can be. Depressing as it is, such calls are only one expression of a familiar worldview, that the poor's problems are cultural and behavioral, and they can and should be shamed out of them. There is a counter-narrative, but how can we amplify that and maybe even inject it into the 2016 election? Rebecca Vallis is the Director of Policy for the Poverty to Prosperity Program at the Center for American Progress, and she's co-host of Talk Poverty Radio. Welcome back to Counterspin, Rebecca Vallis.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you had the experience of debating this issue of exposing and shaming public aid recipients on Fox News, where such ideas thrive. What, I wonder, is your goal as a communicator when you go into a forum like that? And how did you try to turn that particular conversation?
So why would I possibly want to go into the lion's den is what I hear you asking. I think it's a great question. I think that unfortunately Fox News is one of the leading offenders in terms of advancing narratives and myths and misperceptions that really can end up being the basis for terrible policy that hurts not just low-income people, but really kind of working families and everyone but those at the top of the income ladder. And Fox's recurring segment, Entitlement Nation, where you see these dollar bills falling from the sky into outstretched hands, which was the segment that I went on Fox and Friends, is really kind of a great example of how they do this. They hosted what they billed as a fair and balanced debate, as of course what they would call it. And my reason for wanting to go on and to talk about this issue was because I think it really offers a rich pivot opportunity for people who want to actually talk about solutions. The people who advance ideas like creating a poverty offender registry, which is the way that I think of this online database of people who need to be shamed for needing to turn to public assistance, people who advance that kind of idea, like this Lewiston mayor, like Fox News, they're not offering any solutions. What they're doing is they're trying to distract from real solutions. And so what I talked about was, you know what, let's focus on the real problem, which is that we've got these structural barriers to people being able to make a living, like the poverty wage that is our federal minimum wage, and that leaves millions of Americans who are working harder than ever needing to turn to public assistance to make ends meet.
Well, it's interesting because a Fox host and another guest said, you know, almost like we agree with you on the minimum wage, not exactly, but, you know, no one should have to support a family on a minimum wage job, because if you have a minimum wage job, you shouldn't have children. You know, besides the heartlessness of that, presumably it also means that people who lose their job or lose wages or become disabled should retroactively unhave the children that they no longer deserve. You know, I mean, logic along with humanity seems not to be at a premium here.
That's well put, and I couldn't agree more. And I think it also fundamentally misunderstands who it is that's making the minimum wage in America. There's this misconception that, oh, it's just some teenagers who maybe are earning some spending money on the side so they can go to the mall. I mean, the reality is that 88% of workers earning the minimum wage in this country are over age 20, so not teenagers, and that a third have children. And about 40% are over age 40, right? So here we are talking about a population that is definitely not teenagers or even just secondary earners. It's people who are having to cobble together multiple jobs to make ends meet. And even then, that can end up not being enough. I'm reminded of that horrible and tragic story that made national news last year, a woman named Maria Fernandez who lived in New Jersey, and she'd cobbled together four jobs to try to support her family, and one of them was at Dunkin' Donuts, and she ended up dying in her car because she had needed to try and get some sleep in between her four jobs, and there she was parked in the parking lot outside her Dunkin' Donuts that she worked at, and that's where she drew her last breath. I mean, that's the face of poverty in America today, not the people sitting on the couch eating bonbons that Fox News would have you believe is who it is.
Right, right. And the Census Bureau just released data showing that There's little to no improvement in poverty and family incomes, despite a falling unemployment rate, which would seem to undermine that whole get a job argument. But let's set aside the idea that people who rely on public assistance don't deserve children or don't deserve seafood or cookies, you know, which are other things we've heard. What are some of the responses to poverty, legislatively, politically, that to you look possible?
Well, I think raising the minimum wage is something that we have seen a real groundswell of support for across the country. And while we're not seeing conservatives at the federal level willing to entertain, let alone embrace that idea when it comes to raising the federal minimum wage, we are seeing a flurry of activity in states and localities across the U.S. And that is something that has been a real cause for optimism. And it's really the result of many years of successful and tireless organizing by fast food workers and others who are raising their voices and are actually achieving change. You know, other important policies include paid leave. We're the only developed nation in the entire world that doesn't have paid leave, right? And when we're at a point where one in three Americans is just a paycheck away or just a sick child or an illness away from poverty because they could lose their job if they miss a shift at work, you know, that's a situation that really affects a whole swath of the American population and working families. Again, also an issue that conservatives have been very slow to embrace, despite the fact that they claim to now be very interested in poverty and inequality. And a third issue that I'll name, because it is gaining a lot of attention at the federal level as well as in states and cities, is criminal justice reform. Mass incarceration is a huge, huge driver of poverty in America, as well as the criminal records that people can end up facing for the rest of their lives and which are associated with barriers to housing, to employment, to education and training and more. And we're finally seeing traction gained at the federal level and across the country at the state and local level when it comes to actually talking about and enacting policies that would not only reduce mass incarceration, but would also give people a second chance. And just to put a number on that connection, if not for mass incarceration and the criminal records that can haunt people for decades thereafter, our poverty rate in this country would have dropped by 20% between 1980 and 2004. So that's, I think, a real positive trend.
And it also illustrates how, you know, policies don't have to have poverty in their name in order to be anti-poverty in effect, you know. And so we need to really understand how to connect those dots to see what kinds of policy can have an impact on an issue that we all care very much about. Well, let me just ask you finally, when presidential candidates talk about inequality, for example, they mostly talk about the middle class, whatever that means, but poor people are not generally approached as a constituency at all. Really, no one speaks for them, much less to them. What role do you see or would you like to see poverty playing in this election?
Well, I'd really like to see a growing awareness of who is poor in America and the fact that it's not some stagnant class of 14 or 15% of our population who are living in poverty year in and year out. The reality is actually much different. It's that poverty, it's not a lifelong identity, it's an experience, and it's something that actually is a commonplace experience. More than half of Americans will experience at least 1 year of poverty or of being right on the brink of poverty at some point in their lives. And actually, that number rises to 4 out of 5 Americans if you include a year of being unemployed or a year of needing to turn to the safety net. So it's not about some other that, you know, that's a them. I put them in quotes. It's really about us. And I think that would change how people view the policies that we need to be focusing on to make sure that, that we all are not only in a place where we have access to opportunity, but also have security when we experience the messy ups and downs of life.
Rebecca Vallis is the Director of Policy for the Poverty to Prosperity Program at the Center for American Progress and co-host of Talk Poverty Radio. Thank you so much, Rebecca Vallis, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much for having me.
new regulations on smog remain as divisive as ever. That was the headline on a September 30th New York Times story, which balanced what it called concerns of lung doctors that smog or ozone is a public health threat with industry claims that installing new equipment would, in the reporter's words, quote, kneecap American manufacturing and threaten jobs across the country, close quote. Three different industry sources were counterposed with a single representative of the American Lung Association. But if the topic is harmful pollution, is the public really served by coverage that centers the views of the polluters? What's a different way to talk about it? David Barron is managing attorney in the D.C. office of the group Earth Justice. His article, Smog Kills, appeared recently in Politico. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, David Barron.
Thank you very much.
Well, first of all, that smog is harmful to human health is not a contentious claim made by lung doctors. It's widely scientifically established, isn't it?
There are literally thousands of studies that show that ozone or smog is dangerous to health, that it kills people, sends them to the hospital, triggers hundreds of thousands of asthma attacks, and keeps kids and adults away from school and work. We know that this happens at levels way below the current standard, or the standard adopted during the Bush administration, and that's why we need a much stronger one now.
Well, if that's the consensus, is it appropriate to go about setting a standard between what scientific consensus says is not healthy, mind you, but less unhealthy, and what industry would prefer? I mean, is that the way to go about it, sort of splitting the difference there?
Absolutely not. The Clean Air Act requires that clean air standards be set based on one thing alone, and that's protection of health. Cost of implementing the standard can be considered later when you're looking for ways to comply. But in setting the standard, the only lawful and appropriate consideration is what's needed to protect health. And here we have the nation's leading medical organizations, from the American Medical Association to the American Academy of Pediatrics, and the American Heart Association, and the American Thoracic Society, all saying we need a standard of 60 parts per billion to protect people's lungs. And yet today, the Environmental Protection Agency is announcing a standard far above that, at 70 parts per billion, a standard that will allow thousands of deaths, thousands of hospitalizations, and hundreds of thousands of asthma attacks that would be avoided if EPA followed the advice of doctors instead of caving in to industry's wild claims about cost of compliance.
Well, I just want to underscore something you just said. This doesn't represent just a betrayal, as you put it, of the promise of the Clean Air Act. Consideration of costs is actually illegal in setting clean air health standards.
That was ruled more than 14 years ago by the United States Supreme Court in an opinion by Justice Scalia. And this has long been established as the law of the land. And yet we've had industry spending millions and millions of dollars over the past several months arguing that EPA and the Obama administration should violate the law and base its decision on the cost of meeting the standard. And not only is that illegal and indefensible, but it's based on bogus claims of costs. There have now been two studies showing that the industry cost claims are wildly overblown, and that, in fact, clean air standards that are stronger will provide important benefits to the public. And industry has just over the years repeatedly raised these claims that it will cost us too much to have healthy air, and they've been repeatedly shown to be wrong.
Yes, well, I think the economic and the racial aspects of this are often overlooked. An AP analysis of EPA data found that African Americans are some 79% more likely than whites to live in neighborhoods where industrial pollution poses a health danger, and poor people as well more often live with the dirtiest utility plants. So there's also a justice issue here.
Well, there is. You know, science shows that ozone is dangerous to kids and to seniors and to people with asthma. And it shows that disproportionately African-American kids and minority kids have asthma. So when the EPA sets a standard that's too weak, these are the people who will suffer the most. And for an administration that says it's committed to environmental justice to set a standard that's too weak, that's not where the medical professionals say it should be, is just indefensible.
Well, we are taping this on October 1st. You've told us a little bit about the current state of play, the new standard that the EPA is going to release. What happens now? Is this set in stone at this point?
Well, it is for a while. I think it's very likely that the standard is going to be challenged in court by those who want to enforce the law and want to make it clear that this standard is not protective of health, does not follow the advice of the nation's leading medical society, and it's a betrayal of the Clean Air Act's promise of clean air. And so I think that's probably where this is going to be headed next, to the courts, and hopefully we'll see some change.
Well, and helpful in that would be media coverage that would at least interrogate industry's claims, I should think, instead of sort of saying, well, it's a he said, she said type of thing.
Well, you know, that's true. And the sad part about all of this is that we've got these wealthy corporate interests, polluter interests, that have been spending millions of dollars to saturate television and radio with disinformation campaigns about these standards. And the media has just been pretty quiet on this. When you look at the major media outlets, they've given almost no attention to this issue until just the last few days. And it's sad that an issue of this importance that affects literally all Americans has gotten so little attention from our mainstream press.
We've been speaking with David Barron, managing attorney with Earth Justice, online at earthjustice.org. Thank you, David Barron, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The world rolls on hotter than ever. This week on Radio EcoShock, who knew and when? Neela Banerjee from Inside Climate News reveals the investigation into the world's biggest oil company, ExxonMobil. They knew their product would damage the climate, starting in the late 1970s, but chose to fund denial. Then we examine the end of plenty with National Geographic author Joel K. Bourne. He says the projected future of food and population isn't going to happen. There are a few other goodies along the way, maybe even a happy spot. I'm Alex Smith. Thanks for joining in. Let's get started. The world's largest oil company knew climate change would result from their products as early as the 1970s. That's just part of startling revelations coming out of an investigation by Inside Climate News. To get the whole scoop, we've reached their senior investigative journalist, Neela Banerjee. Neela, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
How did you and your team get started on this massive story about Exxon?
As a broader project looking into early climate change research. And as we started to do this, a scientist we spoke to who had worked for the U.S. Energy Department noted that Exxon had contributed to this research into peer-reviewed journals. And we thought that was unusual given the known history of Exxon's involvement in climate, starting from about 1990 on when it worked hard to delay action on climate change. So Exxon got on our radar that way, and then we tried to see if other companies were involved. We didn't hear any mention of any other companies. Then what happened was that, separate from this, I got a transcript of a congressional hearing, a U.S. congressional hearing in 1979, which is much earlier than we thought there'd been hearings on climate change. And just on a lark, it was a PDF document, I decided to look up Exxon. And sure enough, there was a gentleman from Exxon at this 1979 hearing. So the peer-reviewed work had been about 1983, 1984, which to us already seemed quite early. All of a sudden, seeing this man's name, it was Henry Shaw, in that transcript moved the clock back to 1979. So I started to look into, who is Henry Shaw? And started to Google him and discover that he was an author of a paper that was done describing a project launched in 1979 by Exxon using one of its supertankers to take samples of CO2 in the oceans as the tanker went from the Gulf of Mexico to the Persian Gulf. So, that became the thread we started to pull on. Henry Shaw is dead, but one of his co-authors, Ed Garvey, is alive. We spoke to him, and we hopscotched from person to person. We discovered archives, and, through just old-fashioned shoe leather and phone calls, we managed to pull this together.
And, the irony is a bunch of bloggers and denialists, some of them likely receiving funding from Exxon, kept pushing the myth that climate scientists in the 1970s only warned about the coming ice age and not global warming. Doesn't this blow that myth right out of the water?
Yeah, it is a really interesting point. Nobody has mentioned that whole canard until now. And you're right. People to this day continue to mock climate science because they say, scientists said this back in the 70s, and now they're saying that. Well, I actually don't think scientists said it, or maybe it was one scientist and Newsweek covered it. But it's more that Exxon was following the science of the time, or Exxon scientists were following it, and they reported it back to their top executives. In the first story of our series, we have a scene that we got from the documents of one of Exxon's senior scientists, a man named Jim Black, reporting to Exxon's management committee in 1977 about the emerging science around CO2 emissions and climate change. climate change. And he said, you know, the prevailing scientific opinion is that these CO2 emissions come from burning fossil fuels. And in about a decade, it's going to be time to make some hard choices about energy use. He didn't say it in any kind of biased or critical fashion, I mean, other than, you know, scientific skepticism and inquiry. He just laid it out there. It was very neutral. It's what you would expect a scientist in academia to say. And that was the tone from the outset until about 1986, because that's, you know, we have documents for now.
So where did you find all those internal Exxon reports and correspondence from the early days of their climate research?
From various sources, from a lot of archives, you know, went to a lot of different places and found them and digitized them, and we're sharing them, you know, as the stories come out. There's a lot, you know, there's thousands of pages, but and while it completes a picture, the most telling documents, I would say, are maybe, you know, two dozen.
And how far did Exxon go with its early climate research? Can you tell us more?
Oh, sure. So the first project that they launched was in 1979, was this tanker project that I mentioned earlier. And it was ambitious when you think about it. It didn't cost a lot of money as far as, you know, a company the size of Exxon goes. But it meant a lot of coordination among various Exxon divisions, and that's kind of a big deal, according to one of the scientists on the project. And for that kind of coordination to go on, it needed sign-off at the very top levels of the company. So they deployed this tanker. I mean, the tanker was going anyway, taking oil and so on, but they outfitted it with specially made equipment, and they seconded, you know, several men to the project, technicians and engineers and scientists. So they did that from 1979 to about 1982. Starting around 1980, Exxon decided that they needed to know more about climate modeling. Climate modeling at that time was primitive. You know, any scientist could have told you. And Exxon was following it, but they decided to hire mathematicians and atmospheric scientists and others, I guess, but definitely mathematicians, to do mathematical modeling of the Earth's climate and how it would be affected by greater CO2 emissions. And there was an overlap between the tanker project and the modeling. By 1982, the price of oil had fallen precipitously. Exxon was making cuts everywhere. The tanker project seemed expensive, and so they decided to cut that. We don't see any other consideration. It didn't seem like that cut came out of denial or anything like that. But they decided to continue with their modeling efforts, and those modeling efforts continued and generated peer-reviewed papers, some of which were praised by, you know, academics and government scientists. All of that continued until about 1986. Then the layoffs that were happening at Exxon led to a sharp reduction at the research staff. And from 1986 to the present day, Exxon's continued to do climate research, but more narrowly focused, and certainly not anything that would imperil their business. Like, some of the research I've seen looks at whether natural gas is better than coal for the climate, but it doesn't really look at, you know, some of the bigger issues that they were looking at in the early 80s.
Do we know for sure that these scientists managed to warn top executives in the company about the dangerous risks of climate change in those early days?
Yes, we do. We have documents that show that, and we've shared those documents on our website. So, for example, that first meeting I was telling you about that this scientist named Jim Black gave before the management committee. The management committee is the top level of the company. It's the chairman and CEO and the senior vice presidents. They're the men, and they were all men, who made decisions about the company and its priorities. Later, we have documents that showed Exxon's managers and executives from their research and engineering unit, where all this climate research was going on, that they kept senior vice presidents apprised regularly about climate change. We have letters and from managers and kind of lower-level executives all the way to the upper ranks. And then we also have we even have documents that reflect the interest that those men took in climate science. So, for example, there's a memo written by a gentleman from Exxon Research and Engineering called Harold Weinberg, and he writes about a senior vice president pointedly discussing oceans and their role in climate change and the carbon cycle. I mean, they were versed about it, and they were talking to their scientists and challenging them and kicking around different theories. So that was one of the most exciting things in our research, was that The documents we found showed that interest in climate change and climate research went all the way up to the executive suites, and therefore Exxon couldn't say to us, oh, well, yeah, of course, you know, these scientists, they're off doing their own research, and it's, you know, it really doesn't mean anything. It's distant from our bigger corporate considerations. And what we saw was that, you know, they weren't.
Well, I want to get back to how important that is about the role of the executives in just a couple of minutes. But first, I'd like to ask, what does ExxonMobil say about that early research now?
So ExxonMobil has taken a rather interesting position. They own up to it. They said, of course, we did that research, and we've continued to do research for 40 years. And they basically, what they take issue with is our description of the different direction they start to go in 1989 when they joined a U.S.-based coalition called the Global Climate Coalition that worked very hard to delay action on cutting fossil fuel emissions. And that's when here in the U.S. we see this political muscle coming from big business to stop action on climate change, 1989 and onward. And Exxon spent millions and millions of dollars on that denial effort. When we went to Exxon and we said and asked them questions about their research, they didn't deny that the research went on in the 70s, but what they denied was that they actually ever cast doubt on climate change. Or, you know, they make it seem that their response to what they did in the 90s onward, when their chairman, Lee Raymond, was deriding climate modeling, for example, their response to that is, well, our positions have always been in the mainstream of science. And, my question is, well, who determines what that mainstream is? I mean, do you determine it? Because everybody else thinks, you know, has described you as a denier. So it's been a very interesting discussion with Exxon because they own up to the research, but they deny that they ever denied or muddied climate change or perceptions of climate research. And when we've pushed them for greater detail and more detailed responses, they just took their marbles and went home. They are not taking our questions anymore.
Wow. The Global Climate Coalition, it sounds like an activist group, but
in
an Orwellian twist, it's the opposite. Well, okay, folks, you're listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith talking with Neela Banerjee of Inside Climate News. So your project was taken up by the American public broadcasting show Frontline. They're doing a feature on your research. Can you tell us about that, please?
Well, so far it's been rather limited to this series and to that first story. What we might do further with Frontline is still under discussion. So I can't really tell you more than what we've done so far. But they're the ones who definitely secured that footage of Exxon's tanker and the scientists on the tanker and so on. That footage is actually available from the University of Texas archives, the library where the Exxon archives are, and those, you know, those archives are pretty sanitized. It's basically Exxon's public statements, but that footage is there nonetheless.
All right. So it's my understanding that the oil and coal companies learned from the tobacco company campaigns to sow doubt about the science. For tobacco, it was between smoking and cancer. Is that the way you see it?
You know, I think that kind of connection is something that politicians and especially lawyers can – I'll leave it to them to determine that. But what we do see is one place where I think the comparison falls apart between, say, what Exxon was doing, what the tobacco industry did, is that from what I understand, the tobacco industry, you know, the companies got the research results from their scientists, their in-house scientists, and then suppressed them. Exxon did not suppress any of this science. In fact, they publicized it, and they, as I said, they published in peer-reviewed journals. They sponsored symposia on climate change back in the early 80s. They funded research at Columbia and at Woods Hole in Massachusetts, you know, sort of premier laboratories. And so, you know, they understood that climate change and the regulatory response to it could be a risk to their business. The reason that they did their research and then publicized it is because they wanted to be taken seriously when those discussions about curtailing fossil fuel emissions would begin. And they thought, you know, the best way to protect their business was to be a constructive player in the science and in the discussion. Now, that's a very different approach to climate change and the threat that it poses to fossil fuel companies than Exxon took starting in 1989 with the Global Climate Coalition and so on.
So ExxonMobil says they've stopped funding climate denialists. When did that happen, and do you believe them?
So far, don't see any reason not to believe them. I think it happened about 5 years ago.
And are Exxon executives still sowing doubt about the link between fossil fuels and climate change?
They don't really comment on it. You know, we asked their public relations representative, you know, does Exxon accept that fossil fuel emissions are driving climate change? And they don't really, you know, they don't really comment on it.
I think there was one statement by, was it Tillerson, just recently on that?
They don't actually comment on the link between fossil fuel emissions and climate change. They do say that, you know, increased CO2 is driving climate change and so on. The difference is that Rex Tillerson, the chairman, while accepting climate change, believes that human society is infinitely adaptable and that this can be solved not through a reduction in fossil fuel combustion, but by some kind of engineering solution. He sees it as an engineering problem and not as a problem of fuel choice. And when he was asked at their shareholder meeting this year by one of their shareholders, you know, whether Exxon shouldn't invest more in renewable energy, his response was that Exxon does not lose money on purpose, meaning that, you know, he just brushed aside any notion of Exxon having a greater focus on renewable energy. And that comment drew a lot of laughs from his allies there.
Yep, we're going to stay in the oil business until we're driven out of it. That seems to be their position. Well, I asked you about what executives knew and when, because just in the news, a peanut company CEO was sentenced to 28 years in jail for knowingly selling tainted peanut butter, and about a dozen people died and many more people got sick. But when we compare that to maybe 100,000 people killed in climate-fueled heat waves already, more from the spread of tropical diseases, crop failures, floods, forest fires, maybe it won't be too long before oil company executives are hauled before the courts, charged with some sort of climate crimes. What's your opinion on that?
You know, I don't know what the response is going to be. And, you know, and I'll leave it to juries and judges to determine whether that's good or bad. I mean, what, you know, that's not my role as a journalist. You know, if I were a columnist, it would be something different. But I do think that people, you know, we've gotten indications that members of Congress are watching this closely. Now, the Congress is controlled by the Republican Party, and you know, then the Republican Party in the U.S. considers it basically an article of faith to either deny climate change or actually it softened that recently, and they just basically don't want to take any action on climate change. So while the Republicans control the U.S. Congress, nothing will probably happen as far as congressional hearings and so on, akin to, say, the hearings that happened with the tobacco industry decades ago. But if that were to change in 2016 with the elections, then, you know, you might have congressional hearings. If there are attorneys general on the state level that are looking into this and see some way of addressing this through litigation, that might happen. Maybe the Justice Department will take a look at this. We don't really know. We don't, you know, especially entities, institutions like the Justice Department, government lawyers do not talk to us, so we don't have any insights into what they might do.
All right. Well, let's just talk about the giant opportunity lost when Exxon decided to fund climate denial instead of following up on their early research role. I wonder, what could they have done instead?
Perhaps we should start with what they did. What they did starting in 1989 was not just join this global climate coalition, but over 25 years, they funded as climate denier organizations. And what, and especially what a lot, what the think tanks they funded do is that they create an artificial narrative, not based on science, that says that you know, that the science is too murky, it's too uncertain, and that the changes to the economy are too expensive, so we shouldn't take action. And these institutions look reputable. They've gotten all this money from Exxon and other climate deniers, and so then Exxon can point to these institutions, which they started, and say, see, you know, this reputable institution says that we shouldn't take action. You know, Exxon's allies in Congress or even in the White House can also point to the studies that these various front groups do. And so, you know, what you have is an enormous infrastructure that Exxon funded that generates fodder for their arguments and that creates doubt. And that has helped enormously to delay action in the United States on climate change and to muddy public perceptions of
what's really happening and what scientists really think. So if Exxon had not taken that position, if Exxon had continued to do research, even if it had remained neutral, I think that machinery of doubt would be less powerful than it is now. And there might have been a greater push to get something done. If Exxon had actually followed the science and said, you know, we are going to gradually shift away from fossil fuels and focus more on alternative energy, then, you know, we might actually be looking at an entirely different landscape in the United States. And there might be a carbon tax now, or cap and trade, or a greater use of alternative energy, including in the transportation sector. And that would have really changed the game. We won't know, will we? Because it didn't happen.
So this is part of a series you're doing. What's coming up next?
What's coming up next is, well, so today we ran a story about modeling, Exxon's internal climate modeling, and how that confirmed the scientific consensus, and they actually used words like consensus, words that they derided a decade later in the 90s. Coming up next week, hopefully next week, is a story about how Exxon's understanding, their corporate understanding of the risks that CO2 posed to the environment, how that understanding shaped certain business decisions that they made in the 80s. So not, you know, in the 90s or even now, but 35 years ago.
For anyone who doesn't know, Neela, what is Inside Climate News and where do people find you?
So Inside Climate News is a nonprofit, very small nonprofit investigative news site focusing on climate change issues. We won the Pulitzer Prize 2 years ago for a series about a pipeline leak, and we are funded by American foundations, and we can be found at insideclimatenews.org.
Insideclimatenews.org, that's pretty easy, and I think people will go and visit you there for sure. Our guest, Neela Banerjee, is a senior investigative journalist with Inside Climate News. They're bringing out a startling new series on early climate research by the oil company Exxon, what they knew and when. Get it all at insideclimatenews.org, and you can find links to some YouTube interviews with former Exxon scientists in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. Neela, thanks so much for your great work and for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. There is no doubt in my mind that executives of companies who know climate change will cause incalculable damage to our civilization and all nature will eventually be charged with crimes against humanity and against nature, at the very least. It may be posthumously for some. Others will be brought out, as we saw the 80 and 90-year-old Nazi war criminals still prosecuted. There are not enough words to describe the enormity of knowing your product will wreck the climate, knowing that the public could have and should have been warned, and trying to hide it all to make a buck. When cities go underwater during storms and then permanently, when fires and floods wreck our homes, when the species say goodbye forever, when the heat of hell breaks loose, surely that is beyond forgiveness. I'm Alex Smith, that's my opinion, and this is Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
There is another future cast sure to wreck on the rocks of harsh reality. The United Nations predicts there will be over 11 billion humans on the Earth by the year 2100. Our next guest explains why that isn't going to happen, and why most of us have already lived the most prosperous years of our lives. Throughout history, there have been times of mass famine until this century. Children today have hardly heard that word in the news. That may be about to change. Joel K. Bourne Jr. is one of the top agriculture journalists. His work appears regularly in National Geographic and other publications. His new book is The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. Joel Bourne, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. It's nice to be here.
Well, ever since Malthus in the 1700s and up to the Ehrlichs in the 1970s, people have been warning there's an upper limit to the food we can make on this planet, yet we seem to be feeding billions more people. Why should we pay attention to the idea of peak food now?
Very good question. And of course, when we're here in the United States in the land of plenty, it's with the grocery stores shelves still full, it's kind of curious to talk about world hunger. And yet, what we've seen since the turn of the century in 2000, we started to gradually see demand outstripping supply. So in the first 12 years since 2000, we actually consumed or otherwise utilized more of the three major grain crops, rice, wheat, and corn, than we actually grew in 8 out of the 12 years, the first 12 years of this century, which was part of the thing that triggered the enormous volatility of food prices that occurred in 2008 and again in 2010 and again in 2012. So what we're starting to see is very highly volatile food prices based on this relationship, but where our demand from population growth, increased meat consumption, and our increased use of grain for biofuels is putting a lot of pressure on our global grain supplies.
It sounds like a simple, almost stupid question, but how could humans consume more food than we produce?
Oh, well, because every year we typically produce more than we need, and we put it in storage, essentially. We have overages on good years that we store. And so what happened was we have been whittling down our stockpiles to some of the lowest levels we've seen since the 1970s, when about a quarter of the world's people were hungry. And this is another thing that causes markets to flutter, because when they see the stockpiles getting down to 68, 70 days of supply, then it makes the investors start to really worry and starts the prices to rise. So, again, we're not talking about eating more than we grow. We're talking about using up the old grain from the previous year.
So one person who's been keenly watching grain supplies is Lester Brown. He founded the World Watch Institute and then the Earth Policy Institute. Has Brown affected your own work?
Oh, absolutely. He was one of the inspirations for this. He's one of the few people who've really taken a hard look at agriculture and its impact, not just on ecosystems, but the climate and on population and on our economy. And, of course, Brown was the first one to raise the flag about who's going to feed China in the early 1990s. And I spend an entire chapter in the book talking about China's incredibly stringent growth in meat demand, where they're eating more and more hogs every year as their population increases in wealth and more of their people move into the middle class. They tend to eat more meat, and their meat consumption has almost doubled in the last decade alone, and it's projected to keep on growing. Same with India, although there they're eating more dairy. And when people eat more meat and more dairy, it's a multiplier effect for grain, because these livestock tend to be fed either corn or wheat in many parts of the world. So that's part of the problem. And, of course, Lester Brown has been on it, oh, gosh, since the 1960s, yeah.
I think one good example that you write about is Egypt's food problem. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Egypt is one of these incredible examples. It's sort of the world food problem in a nutshell. So Egypt used to grow enough wheat to feed all its people in the 1960s, even enough to start even export wheat to some of its neighbors. But because of population growth in Egypt has almost quadrupled since the 1960s, their farmers were just unable to keep up. Now, Egypt eats more wheat per capita than any other nation in the world. They are so dependent on it, they call it Aish, which is their word for life. And as a result, they have become one of the greatest or the largest importer of wheat on the planet. And so they are so dependent on the world grain markets that when we saw the big fluctuations in wheat prices, where they tripled in 2008 to the highest inflation-adjusted prices since World War I, we saw bread lines in Egypt. We saw food riots. Several people died in the scramble to get subsidized bread that the army, they had to call in the army and the army bakeries to make for the people. It was just a tragic food crisis, and it was not the only country that experienced it. About a dozen other countries had food riots around the world that year.
You know, Joel, we've had scientists on this show say that climate change may have begun almost 10,000 years ago with the development of agriculture, but how is modern agriculture adding to climate change?
Great question. And I talked to a couple of chapters of this in the book. Because of the way we currently farm, with our heavy petroleum-invested agriculture, you know, most of our fertilizers derive from ammonia and natural gas, as well as other that's mined. It's very chemical, very oil-intensive. We are actually contributing the whole food production system a third of global emissions every year. We are literally farming ourselves out of food this way. And this is why. A study came out a few years ago on looking at the projecting the impacts of climate change on our ability to grow food for ourselves. This is from the Royal Society in London, one of the oldest scientific groups in the world. And they projected if we get to a 4 degrees Celsius increase, which our emissions are currently on track to do by the end of the century, it could make half of our agricultural land either less suitable or even unsuitable for agricultural use. So at that point, our population is projected to be 11.2 billion people. So that's adding 4 billion more people on the planet, four more Chinas, four more Indias. So feeding that many more people with half the available agricultural land is one of those real facts that just studies that I sort of stood up and said, wow, this can't happen. There's no way these numbers can meet, and we have to do something about it, or else millions upon millions of people are going to find themselves in very, very dire straits.
Well, I've seen maps showing how deserts may spread around the subtropics, and that includes the U.S. Southwest. But also, rising seas could flood some of the world's most productive and populated river deltas. Did you look into that?
We did. Places like Bangladesh, where so many people live in these flood-prone areas and where so much rice is produced for these countries, are in the crosshairs of climate change. The other thing we look at in the book is the melting of the glaciers, the great Asiatic glaciers in the Himalayas, all of which are losing mass. And they feed, they are the main water supply for these tremendous rivers that irrigate vast swaths of Asia. Fully half of Asia is fed by the meltwaters of these rivers that are disappearing because the glaciers are melting. So these are other ways where water is becoming increasingly constrained around the world, both for irrigation, but also as sea levels rise, flooding these incredibly important delta areas that produce the bulk of Asia's rice. Yes, they're sort of caught in a vice in that way.
Vegans and vegetarians claim meat is a big part of the world food problem, and you alluded to that already. Could you enlarge on that?
Oh, absolutely. I mentioned one study in the book that says if you feed your average family of four a hamburger dinner, it's like taking them for a 100-mile ride in your car. The emissions and the grain needed to, and grain and water needed to grow cattle particularly, is incredibly high. It's one of the least efficient ways to produce animal protein. So we talk about, one of the easiest and simplest things we could do to reduce our demand on the planet as well as the food supply is to eat less meat, particularly red meat like beef. The good news is aquaculture, which I've written a whole chapter on, can be done in a very sustainable way, particularly when you grow omnivorous fish that don't require small pelagic fish for feed. Incredibly efficient way to grow very healthy animal protein that's delicious and healthful, full of omega-3 fatty acids, everything that we need if we can just sort of transition off the hamburgers and on to the fish sticks. If you can get population to move in that direction, we'll do ourselves all a great favor.
Well, we have a lot of aquaculture in British Columbia, but it has polluted some of our fjords, and there are some difficulties with the Atlantic salmon being raised in the Pacific escaping. So are there ways that we can get around the drawbacks to our present form of aquaculture?
Oh, absolutely. And again, most people are sort of scared of aquaculture because of the experience they've had both with shrimp farms in the tropics, tearing up mangroves, as well as the salmon farms, growing exotic species in areas with all this escapement and disease. But there are many ways we can grow fish that are both fish and shellfish that are actually beneficial to our local coastal environments. And actually, I did mention in the aquaculture chapter, a researcher at the University of Vancouver who's looking at this thing called integrated multitrophic aquaculture, where he's grown about 12 native species in one experimental aquaculture farm, a former salmon farm, and all of them are sort of feeding off the waste of the other. So he's feeding one species, which is black cod, delicious fish, very highly prized, surrounding the pens with sugar kelp, growing lantern baskets full of scallops, and even has sea cucumbers on the bottom, sort of hoovering up the waste that everything else has left behind. So this wonderful sort of cyclic route. I call it like an aquatic organic garden, where he's got a number of different species that he's producing that are all living very low on the food chain and also helping to clean the water as they do it. So there are many ways we can produce fish and shellfish that actually clean up local waters. Shellfish, oyster farming in particular, is a great way, and mussel farming, to get sediment and nutrients out of the water.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Joel K. Bourne, author of the new book, The End of Plenty. We're talking about the food you eat. Well, Joel, we talked about climate change, and one big driver of that is deforestation. Is that all due to demand for wood and paper, or is food also behind deforestation as well?
Well, food is a huge driver, Alex. And one of the chapters when I talk about, we're looking at the enormous increase in hog production in China. China no longer grows enough grain to feed both its people and its hogs. So they've moved on to the market en masse to buy soybeans from places like Brazil and Argentina, where the soy revolution just rolled in to Mato Grosso and some of these areas in Brazil that moved the cattlemen out and into the Amazon and contributed to this incredible deforestation we saw there in the 1990s. Now, it slowed in the 2000s to 2010s. We got it down to about 13 million hectares a year, still apocryphal, but lower than it was. But only recently, as the price of soybeans rose, we started to see deforestation increase again in Latin America. And again, that's unsustainable. There's no way we can do that. Now, if we don't increase our production, and scientists now say that we need to almost double the amount of grain that we're currently producing by 2050. If we don't do that, then the other alternative is to expand into these forested areas, and some estimates have put that as much as 1 billion to 1.5 billion hectares of new land that will be coming out of the forest, and of course that would be a terrible thing for our climate.
How big a factor are biofuels in diverting food production into our cars, and is it just happening in the United States?
Biofuels are a huge factor. I mean, we're currently dumping 40% of the U.S. corn crop, and the United States is the Saudi Arabia of corn. We're dumping 40% of our corn crop into our cars through corn-based ethanol, and that's enough grain, to put it in perspective, to feed everyone in Africa for a year. It's an enormous amount of grain and also enormous amount of land that's being taken out of food production. In Europe, of course, they run mostly diesel vehicles. They're doing very similar things through these government mandates with things like rapeseed, canola oil, sunflower oil that is displacing land that once grew wheat. So, again, these things are shoving food grains aside and increasing prices so that they're now actually making food prices directly linked to fuel prices on the world markets, which is not a great way to go. Now, everyone has said, oh, well, this is just a transition. We're going to move out of these crops and into second-generation biofuels that don't compete with food crops. But unfortunately, that just hasn't happened. 90 to 95% of all the biofuel produced in the United States comes from corn ethanol still. And unfortunately, the second-generation biofuels have not made a dent in our massive biofuel mandate. So weaning ourselves off food grain and biofuels is one of the easiest and best things we can do.
One of the big themes of your National Geographic article and the book, both titled The End of Plenty, is the role of the Green Revolution. But was it really green in the environmental sense of the word?
Not at all. It was green. It was labeled green by the head of USAID at the time, who was referring to the greening of the fields. But it was in no way green as we think of that today in terms of environmental impacts. It was a double-edged sword. Even though it produced an enormous amount of food and basically went from having about 30% of our global population in constant hunger to about 12% today, the environmental impacts were severe. We've got enormous groundwater and estuary pollution from all the fertilizers we're dumping on our bread baskets. We've got pesticide pollution that's contaminating groundwater and causing horrible health effects in places like India, where I reported on in the book. And, it's just the water use has just been dramatic. People think of the Green Revolution as high-yielding seeds, fertilizers, and pesticides, but none of them work very effectively without irrigation. And what we've seen is enormous drawdowns of our groundwater aquifers thanks to the irrigation that was promulgated by the Green Revolution. So we're seeing constraints and impacts on all those fronts.
You know, few people are aware that British Petroleum put out a report saying that affordable gas and oil that companies could really use and make money on will be gone in 50 years. What does that mean to these projections for world food production?
You know, that's really interesting when they talk about affordable oil, because, you know, many of my colleagues reported on the peak oil phenomenon that they thought was going to happen in 2000, and that was right before fracking and all these different types of deep water oil resources came online, and suddenly now oil is cheaper than it's been in 30 years. So some of these projections have gone by the wayside, but certainly our energy demand is very closely connected to our food demand. One of the chapters in the book I focus on is organic agriculture, which are using much fewer fuels, much less energy to grow basic crops that are competitively in yield to conventional crops. So there are ways we can farm that is not so energy intensive, that's also better for the planet and better for our water supplies for sure.
Are genetically modified crops going to save us from a world food crisis?
Well, you know, when I was at NC State, these were touted as the miracle crops. The technology was just coming out in the early 1980s when I was in ag school, and my professors were sort of beside themselves with what these things were going to do for us, right? We're going to be able to vaccinate all the children in the world from treatable diseases with carrying the vaccines and the foods they ate. You know, we're going to be able to reduce nutrient deficiencies by putting the nutrients in the staple crops. And here we are 35 years later, and we've got two blockbuster traits from GMOs. We've got the Roundup Ready transgene and the BT transgene. And they're both, while they haven't caused the great environmental or health problems that we were afraid of, they haven't done an enormous amount of good. They've helped us reduce the amount of toxic pesticides we sprayed on crops like cotton, and they've helped with some soil erosion issues in the Midwest by allowing us to farm no-till with Roundup. But, you know, we're already starting to see resistance to these pesticides and herbicides. And now the big companies like Monsanto are starting to breed new things that are resistant to older, more toxic chemicals like 2,4-D, which is really almost like going backwards. These chemicals have been around since the 1950s and 60s. So it's really not the right way to go. However, the technology is getting so much cheaper. It's now becoming in the realm of the land-grant researchers, the nonprofit researchers, who are just now starting to use that technology to make crops that benefit poor farmers in Asia and they have great public benefits. So I think the technology is powerful. We have to view it on a case-by-case basis. But I think it's too promising to just put on a shelf and say, you know, we're not going to do this. The problems ahead of us are so large. I think we're going to need every tool in the toolbox to address them.
You know, a lot of people in the West presume that famine or at least persistent hunger may reappear in faraway places like Asia or Africa. But we've just seen a scientific study showing that the drought in Syria starting around 2006 drove a lot of farmers off the land. And maybe that's part of the refugee crisis we're seeing in Europe right now. So food is now so global, it can all come back to us one way or another, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. And I think once we're looking at the true causes of what's happening in Europe, whether it's through Syria or Afghanistan, if you look at Yemen, you look at any of these countries, food security is almost at the rock bottom. They're having an extremely difficult time feeding themselves. Parts of the Horn of Africa that are moving up through Libya, same problem. They're having enormous problems. And this is not only a food security issue, but it's, as we see in Europe, it's becoming a national security issue. And one of the gentlemen I interviewed and who blogged for the book was General Hugh Shelton, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the United States, who recognizes this. He was in Sarajevo in Yugoslavia, and he saw all these what hunger can do to people and how desperate it makes them. And I think we're seeing some of that now. Unless we can come up with a better way to farm to help these communities, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, feed their people better, then I think this is just the beginning. We're going to see a lot of migration, a lot of people trying to get out of areas that can no longer sustain them to places that can. And I don't think the United States is going to be immune. We'll see a lot of the same thing in Latin America, South America, with people trying to come north.
Well, on the other hand, tell us about a couple of the more positive solutions that you've found popping up around the world.
Yeah, the first part of the book really looks at the great challenges, the hurdles we have to feed everybody equitably by 2050. And the last half of the book really looks at these solutions. So one of the great ones, of course, is yield gaps. Places like the United States, Europe, Australia, China have enormously high yields, partly based on the Green Revolution paradigm, but also partly based on some of the organic, what some of the organic growers are doing. Now, other places like sub-Saharan Africa, South Asia that I mentioned earlier, have very low yields, pathetic yields. And yet with technology we have off the shelf, either agroecological or conventional, we can help those people grow an enormous amount of more food just by getting them up to sort of the world average for their maize yields or their wheat yields or their rice yields. Now, irrigation. Well, we talk a lot about that in the book in terms of using micro-hydro, or what we call our micro-irrigation, that's now becoming very cost-effective for even the poorest farmers to use, which has a 90% efficiency. So even if you've got a limited amount of water, you can use that very effectively to help increase your yields. And irrigated cropland yields 2 to 3 times that of rain-fed cropland. So it's an easy way to do that. Not easy, not cheap all the time, but certainly effective, and if we can help them do that. We can certainly cut out grain-based biofuels. Man, that's low-hanging fruit. We can eat lower on the food web, which reduces our demand for beef and other grain-intensive meats that makes more grain available for others. So, you know, even in developed countries, we eat far too much meat, eat far too many calories as it is. So cutting back on our own consumption is enormously important. And the biggest thing, I think, and the thing that I stress in the last chapter of the book, is we need to foment a pink revolution in many parts of the world. And what I mean by this is we need to help these countries where women still on average have 5 to 7 children during their lifetime make the demographic transition to having 2 or 3, getting their fertility rates down to replacement value. And we do this fairly simply by educating girls through at least the 6th grade, ideally through high school, and by educating women, giving them equal rights to men in many of these countries, you unleash an enormous amount of potential for half of their population. And we've seen that every time they get, you know, have access to family planning services, have access to contraceptives, and are educated to at least the 6th grade, fertility rates drop on their own without sort of draconian one-child policies or forced sterilizations that we saw in the 60s and 70s. It's sort of just the natural trend. And if we can do anything we can to help that, then we'll be in, you know, we'll be doing them a favor and helping, and, you know, liberate their women, and we'll be doing ourselves a favor by helping them become more self-sufficient.
Joel K. Boren has the most complete and authoritative work I've seen on the giant subject of world food. It's called The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. You can find out more at joelkboren.com, and you'll get more links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. I know you've been swamped with interviews, Joel, so thanks so much for taking the time to join us on this important subject.
Alex, it's a great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. Our storybooks are filled with wild and magical animals, spotted jaguars, crafty tigers and friendly tigers, elephants who can never forget, and crocodiles with sore teeth. Sadly, hidden behind the roar of human-based news, all that is disappearing in our lifetimes. Next week, I'm going to talk with the Venerable Paul Ehrlich about his new book, The Annihilation of Nature, Human Extinction of Birds and Mammals. But first, I'll let Paul tell you a little bit about some of those animals in this clip from a video made by the Woods Institute.
Elephants are in deep trouble, and this is a forest elephant that's in deeper trouble than most. It was only recognized recently that forest elephants were a distinct species, and I think that distinct species may last a couple more decades at best. And this is the Indian rhino, which is very rare, like all the other rhinoceroses except the white rhino. It's severely endangered, and I suspect it won't be around for more than half a century. I don't think maybe any rhinoceroses will be around outside of zoos. The jaguar is the big spotted cat of the Western Hemisphere, sort of our equivalent of the leopard. Its range is shrinking, although it's a big range, and it may hang on to the end of this century. Nobody knows for sure. But fortunately, cats do breed well in captivity, so there'll probably be some live ones around as long as there are people around, but they won't be out in nature. Mouse lemurs, like all lemurs, live on Madagascar, and for a long time we thought there was just 2 kinds of them, but now I think they've discovered there's about 21 kinds of them. And a lot of them are very severely endangered because, of course, when you take two relatively rare animals and then divide them up by 10, they tend to occupy smaller areas and be more threatened. Bonobos or pygmy chimpanzees are our closest living relatives. They are more like us than standard chimpanzees. They solve their disputes by genital rubbing, which is something I highly recommend for our species. I think that they're going to be the next of our relatives to disappear. Grizzly bears are a good example of animals that were once very widespread and abundant and are now still widespread, but nowhere near as widespread. But they're becoming rarer and rarer. And, of course, they compete with human beings and sometimes even eat them. I think they'll be around for quite a while because there's going to be a lot of human beings for them to eat. Tigers eat human beings just like grizzly bears do, but they're very highly persecuted. And although there were many different kinds long ago, several of the subspecies have already gone extinct, and all the others are rare. And I think they'll persist in zoos for a long time because they breed well, but by the end of this century, there are going to be few, if any, left in nature. Pangolins are weird-looking animals that are still quite common in many parts of Eurasia, southern Eurasia and Africa. But they're extremely valued in Chinese medicine and things like that. Their hair is formed into weird-looking scales, and the scales are actually used. And thousands of them are now being harvested to support Chinese medicine and similar things. So they're all basically in trouble. Albatrosses are fascinating birds that stay aloft essentially forever, except when they're breeding. They're in deep trouble very often because they get tangled in fishing lines. One of the most interesting animals in Africa is the wild dog or the hunting dog, which hunt in packs and have been severely endangered, among other things, by distemper transferred from domestic canines. They hunt as pursuit hunters and run down prey and then gobble it down and bring it back and throw it up into the mouths of their young at their dens. Fascinating animals, not long for this world.
That was Paul Ehrlich. Be sure and tune in next week for our full-length interview. I've just got time for a couple of eclectic bits. Terence McKenna explains why the world is full of idiots. I've always wanted to know that. And then Diana Lindley charms us with her song, Lovelution. Here is the late Terence McKenna.
The great evil, in my humble opinion, which haunts our enterprise, and I say this realizing I'm setting the fox among the chickens, the great evil that has been allowed to flourish in the absence of mathematical understanding is relativism. And what is relativism? It's the idea that there is no distinction between shit and shinola. That all ideas are somehow operating on equal footing. So one person is a chaos theorist, another is a follower of the revelations of this or that New Age guru. Someone else is channeling information from the Pleiades. And we have been taught that political correctness demands that we treat all these things with equal weight. Because we have no mathematical ability, no logical ability, we don't know how to ask the questions that expose some positions as preposterous, trivial, insulting to the intelligence, and unworthy of repetition. So we all are very comfortable bashing science and flailing away at that. But that isn't our enemy. Science is capable of undertaking its own reformation and critique and has been engaged in that fairly vigorously for some time. The enemy that will really subvert the enterprise of building a world based on clarity is the belief that we cannot point out the pernicious forms of idiocy that flourish in our own community. And this problem is growing worse all the time. I mean, just pick up a copy of Magical Blend or Shaman's Drum, and you will discover an appeal to the level of intellect that makes what's going on with television advertising look like a meeting of the Princeton Institute of Advanced Study. We have tolerated too many loose heads in our community. We are not willing to take on the karma involved in argument and discourse that actually gores somebody's ox, so that at the end of the day, iridology or Mormonism or some other form of institutionally supported foolishness lies in shreds on the floor. We consider this politically incorrect. I can feel the tension in this room because people sense I might gore their particular ox. If we had learned mathematical logic or reason or rules of evidence, when someone approaches us excited to inform us that the ruins of Lemuria have been spotted in the deep sea off Big Sur or something like that, we would be able to respond to that with the contempt it deserves. I had a conversation about this recently with someone who, if I had to describe their job category, I would describe them as mafiosa. And I said, what do you think of the abduction phenomenon? And without hesitation, this person said, there are just so many foolish people in the world. And to me, all of these things are intelligence tests. And the people who pass the intelligence test are not worrying about pro bono proctologists from other star systems on a night in their bedrooms. So, you know, we have perfected politeness. We have perfected the ability to listen to damn foolishness without betraying by so much as the flick of an eyebrow that we realize what we're in the presence in of. Now I think it's time to refine our mathematical skills, learn to think straight, and not be afraid to denounce the pernicious forms of foolishness which are vitiating the energies of our community and making us appear marginal and absurd in the discourse about truly transforming society.
That was Terence McKenna. Diana Lindley is a Canadian, a Vancouver Islander, who feels driven to get this song, Lovolution, out there. There are several versions, including a very neat YouTube video which features childlike crayon drawings by the Japanese team of Kanata and Yoko Kikuchi. The full-length version was made for the New York City Climate March. You can see all that on YouTube. Let the skeptics and the harsh critics lay down their weary burdens. Let's reach for the child inside and for the children at our side. We need to find a way to end our war against nature. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about your world.
Climate change affects everyone.
Come, come, and join this revolution. Warriors, heed the calling of your hearts. Come, come, be part of the solution. Wherever you are, it's a place to start. Human life. Time has come for the world to unite. We need to take action right now. Come on, come on, come on. Grandmother Turtle's going to lead the way, guide us to strong and wide enough for everyone. Buenos Aires or Montreal, Bangkok or Istanbul, Cairo or Monaco.
Take action right. right now for ourselves, for our families, for our future. For together we can save the world we love.
Whoever you are, with what you've got, follow your heart, play your part. Whoever you are, take action right now. Come on, come on, come on, join the revolution. Warriors heed the calling of your heart. Come, come, be part of the solution.
We're here at the Freedom Alley. You want to tell me what freedom means to you?
Freedom means to me that you have the right to pursue your own happiness. First.
Is a freedom which ends a prohibition which existed for the last 60 years based on a corporate lie.
What is freedom to you?
You're asking me right now?
I'm asking you right now.
Right now? Freedom is the right to smoke weed!
Green tent right over here is a place where you can put down your signature to help us get the Bay State repeal on the bill and help us vote to legalize marijuana.
Boston Freedom Rally! Hemp Hemp Parade! Hemp Hemp Parade!
One more.
Hemp Hemp Parade! I hope you're having a hempy day!
Freedom is the opportunity to express yourself in any form that you'd like, that doesn't cause harm to anyone else or the greater good.
And why are you here today?
To celebrate freedom.
I mean, I love weed. I think it should be legal, yeah.
I'm Ashley, and what freedom means to me is do what you want to do, do you. It's your life, live it. There you go.
And there it was. Thousands of people gathering on Boston Common on September 26th and 27th to share their love of weed and their dislike of marijuana prohibition. All fun and high-stoning society aside, there were serious issues to tend to. One of the main focuses of the event was to gather signatures for Bay State Appeal, which is a petition drive for a ballot initiative to put legal marijuana to a popular vote next year.
In 1989, when Dick Evans helped us get a rally going in North Adams, in Memorial Day weekend, hey, it was rigging years, it was bad. Then in 1990, I met Linda Noel. And we were at the USS Constitution, and that fall we founded an organization, the Massachusetts Cannabis Reform Coalition. And we knew that this day would come when our Freedom Rally would be the initiative petition kickoff. You cannot leave these premises if you are a Massachusetts voter or eligible to vote without signing this petition. It's the one that has the B on it. It's Bay State Repeal.
That was Steve Epstein, one of the founding members of MassCAN, the Massachusetts Cannabis Reform Coalition, which is the sponsoring organization of this annual Boston Freedom Rally, and the group responsible for the recent decrim and medical victories. They now have their sights set for full legalization. Another serious topic was the opposite of freedom, the United States of Incarceration. Gene Saros, one of the MassCAN board of directors, addressed this.
I want to tell you about a very important program that's on HBO tomorrow night at 9 p.m. It's called Vice. and it is about mass incarceration in the United States. One of the main reasons that these politicians in Washington aren't moving to take cannabis off the Schedule I list is because we have for-profit prisons in this country. We have more prisons in America than we do schools and universities. And that's really, really messed up. And that needs to change. Our President Barack Obama has gone to federal prisons. The first sitting president who has visited federal prisons to talk to people. And he's starting the conversation on this. And we need you all to be activists. We incarcerate more people in this country per capita than any country in the world, even more than China and Russia. And 20% of the population in our prisons are there. The people are nonviolent drug users, like cannabis users.
Hey, Boston. We are Circadian Clock, and first things first, we love weed! Woo! This is such a wonderful day. This song is called Someone Out There Loves You After All. The affection is fleeting, but my heart's still bleeding out. Cause I see it before me, a kid you adore me now. So
music plays a big part in this event, as it's just as much a concert as a protest rally. Bill Downing, another board member, talks of the protest aspect of the Freedom Rally.
It is a protest, but everybody's having such a great time and smiling and happy and everything. That, you know, it doesn't seem like a protest, because usually you think of protests, it's like, you know, we want our rights, you know, a lot of angry talk, but it's nothing like that, really, you know?
No, it's not. The vibe is very cool, and a lot of people are politically aware. Are you getting lots of good signatures on getting the ballot thing happening?
I think we are. We've got 10 or 12 petitioning stations all around the rally area, and we've got tons and tons of petitions. And so far, from what I can see, it looks like we're getting a lot of signatures. So.
Yeah, well, you've certainly got a supportive crowd here.
Everybody who's here, I think, is a supporter. Unless they're an undercover cop.
But even they're not bothering people. They're just standing on the outskirts, you know, people smoking sort of right in front of them and then paying it no mind.
I haven't seen anything. Actually, I have my ACLU attorney checking right now to find out whether or not there have been any arrests. But as far as I can tell, I haven't seen any. You know?
No, I've seen the cops just being very mellow, kind of just blanketly observing, but not zooming in on anybody.
Right, but I do see people smoking marijuana here left and right all over the place.
Indeed. You not only see it, you can smell it.
My name is Sylvia. Everybody calls me Moody, and I'm from Dorchester. Freedom means a lot to me. I could do as I please and not be bothered by nobody, not go to jail for being free.
So, let's keep it in motion for sure with some more dope hip-hop. A Beast Coast native, hometown representing Boston. If y'all active, please make some noise for Millie's. Hempfest, make some noise! Look,
California,
smoking dope,
sour diesel,
bottle roll.
Local hip hop act Miles with DJ Lotus Sound rock the crowd. Local sports radio celeb Mike Adams also lent his support.
Cannabis is, to some people, mental tranquility. To some people, it's medicine. To some people, it's social activity. To some people, it's business. But most importantly, to all people, it's God-given, no matter who your God is, he or she gave you cannabis. It's given to you in a natural way by nature. So let's make it legal. That's the most important thing. And when's that vote? I'm sorry, I got distracted. I want to thank you all for being here today. I hope you're having a great day. It's a beautiful, sunshiny Indian summer day. And remember what is the most important thing. What was it? Oh, yeah. Have fun in a natural fashion. And once in a while, you can have a shot of tequila, too. Thanks for being here.
Normal founder Keith Strope has been fighting for legal marijuana since 1970. He has the distinct honor of being one of the last people to be arrested at the Freedom Rally back in 2007, the year before the decrim law was passed. I asked him how it feels to know that he can't be arrested now.
Well, in theory, you can still get a ticket because it's public smoking, but I think it's a civil fine. I'm right. $150 or something. I'm delighted that you can no longer be arrested. I mean, the sheer pleasure of that event from my standpoint and from Rick's was that we were able to go into court and testify under oath that, of course, we were smoking marijuana. It's a marijuana rally. Why wouldn't we be? And so they'd never had anybody tell the truth at a trial. You could just see they were shocked. What do you mean you were smoking marijuana? Yes, yes, that's how I was. So it wasn't a surprise that we were convicted.
That one's lit.
No, I'm we were hoping that we might get a hung jury. And we had one potential juror. The judge had given him an instruction, you know, you can set aside your personal views. And this juror said, Your Honor, I don't care if they light a joint up on the chair. I'm not going to vote to convict them. And it was like, wait a minute. Wait, you should have kept that to yourself. That's exactly what we want in the jury room. But, of course, the judge had to strike him at that point.
Dr. Lester Grinspoon is another longtime advocate. He had an interesting story about Carl Sagan.
I was going to say, it started in 1966 when during an anti-Vietnam War demonstration, I met Carl Sagan, who became my closest friend. The first time I was invited to his home for a party, I was so terribly surprised. I had never seen anybody smoke marijuana, and there was Carl Sagan smoking marijuana. Not only was Carl smoking, but almost every other of his friends were smoking. I said to Carl, look, Carl, I have to tell you, this is a dangerous drug and you shouldn't be using it. And he said, Lester, take a puff. It won't harm you. Well, when I discovered that these really solid people were smoking marijuana, I decided I had to ask myself, what was the basis of my telling him it was so harmful?
So that was a very cool revelation, you smoking with Carl Sagan, man. I hadn't heard that before.
Well, look on my internet. I wrote an essay on my smoking with Carl Sagan. He also has he asked him to write an essay for Marijuana Reconsidered. And there is an essay by him in Marijuana Reconsidered. But if you want, look at my website.
What's the address?
Marijuana-uses.com.
That's marijuana-uses.com, U-S-E-S.com, for more information about many of the positive uses of this plant. All those uses aside, most people are out there for the joys of getting high without fear of intimidation. For the magic moment of 420, Rick Cusick of High Times Magazine led the crowd en masse to create a huge cloud of smoke over Boston Common.
All right, in 5 seconds, we're going to start counting, so get your weed ready! Ladies and gentlemen, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, happy 420!
As the smoke filled the air, Tosh.1, son of the famed late Peter Tosh, performed in his father's legacy.
The Surgeon General warns, cigarette smoking is dangerous. Dangerous. Azad, to your health. Does that mean anything to you? We are gonna legalize the marijuana, yeah.
The Freedom Rally is an annual event on the Boston Common, a rite of passage from summer into fall. For more information about it and its sponsoring organization, go to masscan.org. That's masscann.org. This year's rally was the kickoff event to get signatures for a Bay State repeal, getting legal marijuana on the ballot. For the Boston Community Reporters Project, I am Chuck Rosina. Thanks for listening.
Boston, are you feeling? Coming in hot, hot, hot. Fire in some shot, shot.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Chip Berlay, an author and researcher on bigotry and intolerance, who explains the dangers he sees in mainstream support for racism in today's Republican Party. Climate activists Jimmy Betts and Ellen Barfield, who talk about why they're engaged in an 18-day fast in protest of a federal agency's role in permitting natural gas projects that exacerbate climate change. And Rena Steinzohr, professor of law at the University of Maryland, who criticizes the U.S. Department of Justice decision to defer criminal prosecution of General Motors executives for a known auto defect that killed more than 124 people. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
More than 3 years ago, the United States and its European allies ignored a covert peace offer from Russia that could have led to the resignation of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Former President of Finland and Nobel Peace Prize winner Martti Ahtisaari told The Guardian that the U.S. and its allies on the UN Security Council ignored the proposal, believing the repressive Assad regime was about to fall. Over the last 3 years, over 200,000 Syrians have died in a brutal civil war, forcing millions to flee. Ahtisaari recalled that Russia's UN ambassador, Vitaly Churkin, laid out a peace plan that included Assad stepping down after a power-sharing agreement was finalized. In February 2012, Ahtisaari met with the five permanent members of the UN Security Council at the request of the Elders, a group of former world leaders that included Jimmy Carter and Nelson Mandela. There, the Russian ambassador outlined his proposal: a halt to arming opposition groups and immediate dialogue between the Assad regime and the opposition, which would make way for Assad to step down. Since then, the Obama administration has made repeated calls for Assad to resign, and the Pentagon has refused to coordinate with Assad's military in its bombing campaign against ISIS. In recent weeks, Moscow has increased its military support to protect the Assad regime by sending artillery units, tanks, armored personnel carriers, and enough modular housing units for about 1,500 personnel. With its allies in Syria on the defensive, the U.S. and Russia have begun direct military-to-military talks in order to avoid unintended consequences in the air campaign targeting ISIS. In late August, South Sudan journalist Moy Peter Julius was gunned down after he left the office of a weekly newspaper. Moy was the seventh reporter killed this year in South Sudan, which is consumed by a bloody two-year civil war. The reporter's death came days after South Sudan President Salva Kiir warned journalists, quote, "Freedom of the press does not mean you work against the country." Local journalists believe Moy was targeted for his reporting. Tom Rhodes, of the Committee to Protect Journalists, condemned the senseless killing, warning that journalists in South Sudan are increasingly self-censoring their reports, especially on the activities of the rebel insurgency. Under international pressure, President Kiir signed a peace deal with the rebels on August 27th, but has complained provisions of the agreement are unfair, including the installation of rebel leader Riek Machar as first vice president. Already, there have been a number of reported ceasefire violations, with fighting ongoing in the oil-rich Upper Nile and Unity regions. More than two dozen advocacy groups who work on behalf of survivors of sexual assault have blasted a Republican-sponsored campus rape bill for placing restrictions on universities and pressing charges for sexual violence on campus. The bill, known as the Safe Campus Act, which is supported by fraternities and sororities, would bar colleges and universities from punishing students for sexual assault unless the victim of the abuse first reported the incident to police. The measure establishes a more restrictive standard than for punishing students charged with selling drugs or committing physical abuse. Colleges and universities are obligated under the gender equity law, Title IX, to address reports of sexual violence. But the Safe Campus Act would change that by requiring victims to report incidents to the police first. Kristen Hauser of the Penn Coalition Against Rape told the Huffington Post, "We don't force victims of other crimes to interact with the police and file reports and initiate criminal justice investigations." Activists say local police are often not sympathetic to rape victims. For example, women at Duke University complained police have accused them of lying or dressing provocatively when they filed sexual assault complaints. Currently, 136 colleges are under federal investigation for allegedly mishandling sexual assault and harassment cases. This has provoked a growing student movement demanding that university administrators address campus rape. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
The 2016 presidential campaign has, in the view of many Americans, hit a new low with blatant racist attacks against immigrants, Muslims, and other minorities. Some but not all of the bombast has come from Republican frontrunner, billionaire real estate mogul Donald Trump. Trump's campaign seeking the GOP presidential nomination has succeeded in leading the pack of 17 candidates on the strength of the reality TV star's national name recognition, but more importantly, on his blatant appeal to racism and intolerance. Trump's hateful rhetoric against Mexicans and his simplistic, fanciful call for the deportation of 11 million undocumented immigrants and overturning the 14th Amendment that provides citizenship to all persons born within U.S. borders has resonated with many Republicans. More recently, Trump refused to apologize for his failure to contest a statement from a supporter who declared that America has a Muslim problem, and then went on to ask, when can we get rid of them? That episode, along with a statement from GOP candidate Dr. Ben Carson rejecting the idea of a future Muslim U.S. president, exposed the deep veins of intolerance within the Republican Party. A September 1st PPP poll found Trump's beliefs represent the consensus among the GOP electorate, where 51% overall want to eliminate birthright citizenship, 54% think President Obama is a Muslim, and only 29% believe that President Obama was born in the U.S. Your reporter spoke with Chip Berlay, a former analyst with Political Research Associates, who has written about racism and intolerance for over four decades. Here he explains the dangers he sees in mainstream support for racism and xenophobia in today's Republican Party.
Corporate media, for the most part, just was covering the Republican primary hopefuls as a kind of sports reporting. There was no historic knowledge whatsoever. There was no reference to the outlandish bigotry of Trump, but also the bigotry of a number of the other candidates. Trump, by attracting attention as the kind of goofball, raising a lot of dust, basically overshadowed the fact that a lot of the candidates are part of the Christian right and are intensely either Islamophobic or homophobic, and many of them are anti-abortion. And so what we had for a very long time was a kind of mindless reporting of the jockeying for position without people stepping back and saying, oh my God, this is loathsome bigotry. We should stand up against that. And, you know, little by little now you're seeing more and more people writing about the fact that not just Trump, but a whole range of the Republican candidates have various forms of bigotry that I think many Americans object to.
Chip, what is your concern here in terms of this present day presidential campaign when you hear some of the hateful and bigoted rhetoric? What is the end result, you think, in our politics and in our society?
Well, the end result is violence against the named scapegoats. It's violence against our neighbors who are having targets painted on their back by these demagogues who are running in the Republican Party. And the failure, to some extent, of the Democrats and other portions of American society, you could argue that the religious community should be speaking out more. The issue here is that it's a long-standing social science theory that has been demonstrated time and time again since the Nazi genocide, that if you blame a group of people for threatening the existence of the pure ideal community, that over time, some people will interpret that as a call to go either beat them up or kill them. And that has been a basic theory of social science since the Nazi genocide. I have had editors tell me, editors who I have respected over time and who have published my work tell me when I turn in an article, we can't print that because what you're claiming is that this kind of rhetoric leads to violence and that's biased. And I'd say social science isn't biased. It's a fact. You know, there are people all over the political spectrum who have proven this. And they go, well, we can't run your piece because it's biased. So it's the pushback from Fox News, but also a whole range of online right-wing, you know, basically bigoted sites that specialize in slander and degradation of some other, that editors now are afraid to even run basic social science.
What are some recent examples that we can cite here in terms of hate-filled rhetoric leading to violence? I certainly know of one, and I'm sure our listeners will remember, it wasn't just but a few weeks or a month or so ago that a couple of young white men in Boston claimed they were revved up to beat up some Latinos in their community as a result of what Donald Trump was feeding them in terms of campaign rhetoric.
Right. These are well-known hooligans in the Boston area who said to the people arresting them that it was Trump who made them move against beating up these Latino people and urinating on them, I might add, and that they were very proud of what they did. They see their arrest as a kind of a triumph of standing up ahead of the curve against these evil, degenerate forces like, oh, what's the long list, you know, Hispanics, Mexicans, Muslims, gay people, abortion providers, feminists, liberals, UN huggers. The list is very long, and it's bad enough in the mainstream media reporting these statements. But if you go online and look at some of the websites that support these candidates, it's really quite horrific what's being said. And it's bad enough what's being said in the posted articles, but the comments are astonishing. They really are calling essentially for the mass murder of whole groups of people because they're not really honestly American.
In your many years of studying these racist and xenophobic movements, what would you recommend as being the best method of confronting, challenging, and weakening these racist organizations and political movements in addition to the general sentiment that's out there in society?
Well, I recommend that people just strike up conversations with folks at the bus stop, on trains, standing at the checkout counter, their workmates at, you know, in the office, anywhere you can have a conversation with someone about what's going on. Listen to what they have to say. Don't trash them by saying, you know, abolish the white race, you know, end racism now. Say, wow, that's fascinating. I don't see things that way. Here's how I see it. And treat them with respect, knowing that you're not probably going to convince a person who's a dedicated racist or xenophobe or homophobe, but by respectfully engaging them in a conversation with a story about how we as a nation can come together and work through this period, then there's an audience of people listening and thinking about another way of responding to the crisis.
That was Chip Berlay, a longtime researcher on racism and intolerance. He's co-author with Matthew N. Lyons of the book Right-Wing Populism in America, Too Close for Comfort. For more views on bigotry and hateful rhetoric in the 2016 GOP nomination campaign, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On September 8th, a dozen members of the group Beyond Extreme Energy, or BXE, began an 18-day water-only fast in front of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission headquarters in Washington, D.C. Their demand is that the agency, known as FERC, stop issuing new permits to build frack gas infrastructure, including pipelines, compressor stations, storage facilities, and liquefied natural gas export terminals. Plans are to end the fast on September 25th, the day after Pope Francis addresses the U.S. Congress. While the natural gas industry and the political establishment tout gas as the transition fuel to move the nation toward renewable energy sources, recent studies have shown that the extraction process releases large amounts of methane, the main component in natural gas, producing much more greenhouse gas emissions than previously thought. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, who's in Washington, D.C. in a support role for the fast, interviewed two of the people who plan to fast for the full 18 days. We hear first from Jimmy Betts, who participated in the Great March for Climate Action, walking from California to the nation's capital last year. He's been involved in both of BXE's previous week-long actions at FERC and is one of the group's two staffers handling outreach on social media.
The reasons for the fast are to demand no new permits for fossil fuel infrastructure. And in the case of FERC, it's related to fracked gas infrastructure, pipelines and whatnot. But personally, part of my reasons for fasting, especially with water only, as the main idea there in terms of the tactic, is that water in and of itself is one of our most precious resources, and our existence is basically dependent on access to clean drinking water. It's indicative of what it's capable of doing for people. You know, we can live off of water alone for quite a long time, but the second that water is gone, we're down to a few days of survival. So there's a lot that can be stated about it in addition to the issues with fracking.
So how has it gone for you? You're on, you're finishing your seventh day.
Yes. So far, the fast has been going well for me personally. I'm definitely feeling my faculties diminished, and I, you know, can't walk as far as I normally do. And I'm working full time, so it makes it even more of a challenge. So I can't just sit back and relax. I have to actually be on it when it comes down to scheduling work for making sure that what we're developing here and the stories that we're being able to share are getting out into the world. So it's something that I have to balance out and take a little time off now and then to be able to do.
And what do you think has been the response of some of the people going by, you know, our FERC employees? And we can't always tell, you know, a lot of times it's just passersby because we're sort of in the heart of, you know, Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. here. Anything stand out to you in terms of interactions you've had with people?
My interactions have been fairly limited on the street. However, when I go into public spaces or like a cafe to do work on the internet, a lot of discussions come back to the postcard handouts that we have related to FERC or Black Lives Matter, depending on what type of thing we're supporting. And people actually actively talk about 18 days of water only. For what? So they're intrigued more by the action itself, and then they understand, you know, oh, this must be a serious issue. So hearing those conversations was helpful because you don't really know. It's like you're throwing cards into the ether, but people are actually reading them. And they are actually talking about it amongst their peers. So that's important to know.
So, Jimmy Betts, is there anything else you want to say about this pretty amazing and unusual and serious action that's going on?
Well, sure. One of the things that has sort of been an ongoing theme of our actions has been artistic takeaway pieces. And in this case, we have a project called the No New Permits Quilt, and it involves collecting stories from submissions from different frontline groups and also just concerned citizens, because there are many different levels of engagement. And this is one way for people who may not be able to fast that they can contribute stories, and we'll build it into a large quilt that hopefully will just be an ongoing project that we'll keep building onto. So we're looking forward to getting submissions from across the country.
We next hear from Ellen Barfield, a longtime peace activist, who talks about the fast coinciding with the Pope's visit to Washington and the need to take up the work for climate justice. She's engaged in a juice-only fast.
I really like taking advantage of the visit of the Pope. I'm not religious and mostly don't have much use for the Catholic hierarchy, but this Pope is kind of amazing. And if we didn't take advantage of the wonderful things he's saying about a lot of things, including the environment, the earth, climate change, I think that would have been very foolish. So it's good to be here amid a whole lot of other stuff happening.
What draws you to this particular issue of climate change?
Well, I'm primarily a peace activist and have been for 30 years. But I got to say that challenging the Pentagon is definitely being concerned for the environment because they are a huge damager in the environment. But it's very clear that we have to get off the fossil fuels. And to get back to the challenging the Pentagon, they're the biggest single burner of fossil fuels in the whole wide world. So, again, the two go together really well. My husband and I have chosen for 25 years not to own a car. We bicycle. We refuse to have air conditioning because it's such a huge suck of energy. You know, we're doing what we can. But until the whole culture, the whole world gets it together and shifts to renewables and green energy from fossil fuels, we're just getting worse and worse. Individuals can do what they can, but we have to do it as a whole society.
That was climate activists Ellen Barfield and Jimmy Betts, who along with others are engaged in an 18-day fast in front of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission headquarters in Washington, D.C. For more information on the climate change protest at FERC, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Officials at the U.S. Department of Justice have opted not to prosecute General Motors executives for their decision to withhold from the public information about the installation of defective ignition switches into 2.6 million of the company's vehicles, a failure that cost the lives of more than 124 people and injured 274. Instead, General Motors will pay $900 million in penalties, enter into what's called a deferred prosecution agreement, and be monitored for 3 years. A federal court judge recently sentenced former Peanut Corporation of America owner Stuart Parnell to 28 years in prison for knowingly distributing peanut butter that spawned a deadly outbreak of salmonella poisoning that killed 9 people and sickened 714 others. It appears that new guidelines recently issued by the Justice Department calling for more rigorous prosecution of corporate executives engaged in criminal wrongdoing doesn't apply to giant powerful companies like GM. Critics say that the current system, which allows large corporations to evade responsibility for malfeasance that harms consumers, can be remedied by passing federal legislation that will make it a crime for corporate officers to knowingly conceal serious dangers that lead to consumer or worker deaths or injuries. Your reporter spoke with Rena Steinzor, professor at the University of Maryland School of Law, who explains why she condemns the Department of Justice decision not to prosecute GM executives and describes pending legislation that could ensure corporate leaders are held accountable for their actions.
Well, the problem with the cars was that the ignition switches didn't have enough torque. So what that meant was they had a very light trigger, and people were finding that even if they just brushed the key fob, these were compact cars, so they were a little close. They brushed the key fob with their knees. The car might stall, and if you're in the middle of the highway, of course, and your car stalls, you lose power steering, power brakes, and, as it turned out in this case, the airbags wouldn't work. So drivers were put in a position of maneuvering across lanes of traffic, trying to get off on the shoulder. And people were killed. 124 is just the number that GM has acknowledged by the time all the dust settles on the lawsuits that are still pending, the number is likely to be at least twice that. So the company knew, the engineers knew as early as 2002, before the cars even rolled off the line, that there was a problem with the switch. And they sort of didn't say anything about it because, of course, there's a lot of pressure to get new models out. And then problems began to come back, some from GM's own employees who were asked to sort of test drive the cars. So they began to get reports of the stalling. And instead of saying that it was a safety defect, they called it a matter of customer convenience that the cars were stalling. And what then happened was 10 years of palavering, having task forces and work groups and committees and subcommittees, and the company just engaged in this building sort of recklessness of not informing anyone about these cars.
As I understand it, General Motors will now be subject to a $900 million penalty and will be monitored for 3 years, but no executives will be prosecuted. Tell us about deferred prosecution and some of the objections that you have to what's happened with other large, powerful companies, as has happened here in this case with General Motors.
Well, they're really a very wrong way to go about criminal prosecutions. And deferred prosecution agreements have always only been around for about 20 years on this kind of scale. Unfortunately, the Obama administration has been their most enthusiastic booster. You wouldn't think that that would be true in an administration that is committed to equal justice. We have, on one hand, the Justice Department talking tough in some cases, and on the other hand, letting a company like GM off the hook. And its rationale was that the company said it was sorry and that there was a gap in the law somehow so that the company couldn't be prosecuted. And while it's true that laws that deal with motor vehicle defects are weak, and Connecticut should be proud, Senator Blumenthal has some new legislation that would plug that loophole, and I very much hope it passed. He's really been a consumer hero in the Congress. While that is happening, there were other laws that the attorney general could have used to prosecute GM, and it just didn't do it for reasons that are unclear. And the victims, of course, of the families who lost people in these accidents are very disappointed. They can't understand this.
Well, just a final question. What are the chances are that some new legislation that you referred to a moment ago, sponsored by Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal and Massachusetts Senator Edward Markey, what are the chances are that that measure could make a change in terms of auto safety, transparency, and public disclosure?
As for Senator Blumenthal and Markey's legislation, I'm hopeful it will get a serious hearing. But unfortunately, as we also know, campaign financing is so dominated by big business. And both houses of Congress are now controlled by Republicans who are hostile to this kind of reform. So I hope they're both very skilled and talented legislators, and I hope that they can meet this challenge, but it's going to be a rough going.
That was Rena Steinsor, professor of law at the University of Maryland and author of the book, Why Not Jail? Industrial Catastrophes, Corporate Malfeasance, and Government Inaction. Find more views on corporate crime and accountability by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Richard Hill, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Some words from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain.
What you say, what you say, what you say, what? Record like a bomb!
Someone wrote to me and asked my opinion about, quote, shadow governments, unquote, and what I think the solution is. This term, quote, shadow government, unquote, is used to describe those agencies within a government whose existence is kept secret from the public or whose activities are kept secret. It also includes those private entities to whom secret activities are now outsourced, those so-called private contractors doing the government's dirty work. I suppose this idea of shadow governments becomes more and more of a concern to people as they come to realize just how much of the proverbial iceberg is below the surface. The depth and scope of the domestic spying, the vast array of alphabet soup agencies creeping around, unaccountable, taking liberties with our liberties. This is not the government system as advertised in your 1950s civics textbooks, that's for sure. But look, We can't view shadow governments as something separate and distinct from the rest of government. Despite the perception of shadow government as a distinct rogue operation totally divorced from the above-ground, democratically elected, and fully accountable, benevolent government, shadow governments do not exist in that kind of vacuum. Anywhere that you have private contractors spying on American cell phone communications, somebody has appropriated funds for their desks and their pencils, their coffee pots and their toilet seats. Everywhere that you've got a paramilitary whack job in a ski mask lurking in black sites and waterboarding brown people, somebody has appropriated funds for the guards and the rifles, the shackles and the break room vending machines. So, however secret squirrel any operation is, you can trace the toilet paper and the toner cartridges back to bank accounts set up by middle managers with proper authorization, whatever that means. And you can justify those accounts' legality by reading the right authorization bill passed by Congress. My point is, the inception of all the secret squirrel shadow government shenanigans isn't really happening in the shadows at all. Turn on C-SPAN and you can watch it all happen. Live. Right now. No kidding. My point is, we cannot think of shadow governments as some separate evil thing operating apart from our wonderful, responsive, kumbaya government. It's not. It's the flip side of the same coin. Currently, the shadow operators conduct grisly business secretly so that their non-shadow counterparts don't have to directly get their hands dirty. But if we came up with some way to disband all shadow government stuff, if we could click the heels of our ruby slippers and make all of that nastiness go away, we'd only change the world for one day. Tops. If we rid the world of shadow government operations today and made the world safe for mom, apple pie, and the American way, whatever that is, we'd turn on C-SPAN tomorrow to find a new flurry of activities to immediately create new government agencies and to shovel millions of our dollars into them. Plain and simple, when you're in the omelet business, you got to find somebody to crack the eggs. And those egg crackers don't come cheap. Newsflash. The United States government is in the omelet business. And we're all eggs. So there's only one way to do away with shadow government, and that's to get rid of the portion of government in the light that casts the shadow in the first place. It all has to go, because it's all part of the larger complex that functions together. Even the most responsive, limited, accountable government, in the maintenance of its own power and authority, will eventually and inevitably end up with redacted documents in secret files, computer databases filled with information not shared with the folks who paid for the software. Where there's government, there's shadow government. And where there's shadow government, there's a vast population of slaves, monitored, surveilled, controlled, and exploited, held at gunpoint by those who strive to manipulate what everyone knows and, as a consequence, what everyone thinks and does. Freedom demands that we burn the entirety of the master's house, not just half of it. These are the words of anarchist prisoner Sean Swain, held incommunicado on orders of the Ohio prison officials, whose addresses are posted on blastblog.noblogs.org. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at his new address by directing it to Sean Swain, 243-205, Warren CI, P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. President in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org.
in an inherently twisted society that punishes those who rob banks, rather than punishing those who manage them. This seems more than just a little bit unreasonable to me, given that the obscenely wealthy shouldn't store all of their ill-gotten loot in concentrated places, and then irrationally expect the rest of us not to have designs on divesting them of it. Banks are the most prominent symbol for our culture's blind adherence to the institution of property. The fact that thousands upon thousands of banks open up bright and early 6 days a week and close at the end of business with rarely ever a single robbery speaks to just how completely we are caught up in the delusion of capitalism's legitimacy. Some of the most famous figures of American history were bank robbers. Jesse James, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, Bonnie and Clyde, John Dillinger. Robin Hood is a kind of universal archetype, the model bank robber, from an era before the existence of banks. It's both curious and appalling that we have these buildings all around us just filled with cash, while many of us are barely scraping by and struggling for fundamental necessities. We routinely walk past these cash warehouses with holes in our shoes and our stomachs grumbling. A friend of mine, who was more often a successful bank robber than he was an unsuccessful one, shared with me his observation that during bank robberies, police never want to catch bank robbers inside the bank. There's an old movie called Dog Day Afternoon, where two bank robbers are inside the bank when police arrive, and the robbery turns into a prolonged hostage situation. Police want to avoid that. So, according to my bank robber friend, they never respond immediately. They'd rather let you get out of the bank where you can get arrested on the street, or chase you, or follow you with helicopters. So that gives you some time to grab a substantial amount of cash. Also, according to my friend, most bank tellers are trained to do as you instruct. So if you hand them a note with instructions not to trigger the alarm in the drawer, not to include dye packs in the money bag, and not to put a GPS locator in with the cash, they're supposed to comply. Banks don't want tellers to defy bank robbers, get caught doing it, and end up getting somebody killed. For a period of time in the late 1990s, bank robbery had one of the highest rates of unsolved crimes. Robbing banks was pretty fashionable. In fact, in the Cleveland area, there was one guy who successfully robbed several banks, and in each robbery, he left on foot. The guy didn't even have a car. Authorities voiced a hunch that he was probably homeless. Well, he was homeless when he started the crime spree anyway. I would suggest that in this modern era, bank robbery is no longer bank robbery. Consider, in 2008, when greedy banksters bottomed out the global economy, George W. Bush and his Treasury Secretary, Larry Summers, who was himself an alumni of the Lehman Brothers Citibank locker room, decided the big banks were too big to fail. And they offered billions of dollars in bailouts. They gave the banksters money that the government took from you in taxes. When Obama came into office, he got together with his treasury guy, Timothy Geithner, also an alumni from the same crowd of usual suspects, and they continued the billion-dollar bailouts. So that means all of those banks that won't willingly give you any loans have their vaults and registers filled up with your money. So I would suggest to you that it's not robbery to take what's already yours. It's reappropriation. That's no crime. The real crime is letting a single bank get away with keeping it. Think about it. To be successful, all you really need are pistols, ski masks, duffel bags, and an assertive sense of indignation. If we all did it, you know, like setting up an International Bank Fund Reappropriation Day or something, the whole banking system would collapse. It would cease to exist. We would have a future without banks. So if you dream of such a future just as I do, I encourage you to act. After all, that dream is too big to fail. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Warren Correctional Institution in Lebanon, Ohio. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at his new address by directing it to Sean Swain, 243-205, Warren CI, P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. president in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The National Education Association is endorsing Hillary Clinton for president. NEA President Lily Eskelson Garcia says Clinton is a strong leader who will do what's best for America's students because she understands that a stronger U.S. economy starts in America's public schools. Clinton says as president, she will fight to defend workers' rights to organize and to bargain collectively. Wisconsin AFSCME labor leader Marty Beal, known as the Bull of the Woods, has died unexpectedly at home. He was 68. Beal led the Wisconsin State Employees Union and was at the center of Wisconsin's worker uprising in 2011, fighting the attack on public worker collective bargaining rights. In lieu of flowers, Beal's family want donations to a scholarship fund in Marty's name called Kicking Ass for the Working Class. And now here's WIN's Frank Emspach with this week's commentary from Paris.
The European Trade Union Commission comprises 90 union organizations from 39 countries. They met this week in Paris. The trade unionists prioritize the fight against austerity. While the unions are unanimously opposed to the austerity programs of the various European governments, they are divided as to what to do, especially when it comes to industrial action, that is, work stoppages. The unionists also took up the issue of immigration. They urged governments to increase resources for all types of refugee services. To put the crisis in context, a leader of the British Trade Union Council told me that Great Britain had accepted 1 million Polish workers earlier this decade, and that accepting 2 million workers out of a European workforce of 300 million is doable with proper organization. The unions also said that where refugees are able to work, unions will recruit and represent them. All in all, the union attitude was one of welcome and concern. This is Frank Emspach, Workers Independent News.
This is Mitch Lawrence with the Sports Minute for Workers Independent News. Well, if you watched the New York Giants defeat the Washington Redskins, then maybe you saw Kevin Durant of the Oklahoma City Thunder on the Redskins sidelines, decked out in a burgundy-colored jersey and throwing a football around. Well, you know what all the people in D.C. were thinking when they saw that. If that were only another Washington uniform that Durant was wearing. That, of course, the Washington Wizards, his hometown team. We'll know in another 10 months or so if Durant does grant Wizards fans their ultimate wish, because in July of 2016, he's going to hit the open market as an unrestricted free agent. You can expect a lot of teams to bid for his services, too, starting with his own Oklahoma City Thunder. Top suitors are expected to include the Lakers, Miami Heat, and New York Knicks, and also the Wizards, who haven't won anything since 1978. He will merit that kind of attention. Durant was the NBA's MVP in 2014 and is only 27 years old. And when he's right, perhaps only LeBron James is better. But between now and July, there's a lot of basketball to be played, and we'll find out if Durant is fully recovered from a broken foot that limited him to only 27 games all of last season. He had a tricky break called the Jones fracture and needed three surgical procedures to fix it, including a bone graft. Now with NBA training camps open, here's hoping that Kevin Durant can stay on the court no matter where he ends up playing.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Can grassroots online resources like WikiLeaks and Anonymous potentially function as a reliable check and balance on government? What is behind the secrecy surrounding the international agreement known as the TPP, and how has it been penetrated? What are the principal concerns with the TPP? Is there a motive behind this agenda that goes beyond the rhetoric of improving trade between and among nations? How have other countries confronted the agreement, and in what ways can Canadians fight back? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we examine the question of state secrecy, the need for transparency, and the role of online whistleblower tools like WikiLeaks in providing that transparency in government activities. For the bulk of the show, we'll hear an analysis by Melbourne-based scholar and writer Binoy Kempmark. On this week's program, TPP, WikiLeaks, and the Redistribution of Power, a conversation with Binoy Kempmark. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of October 2, 2015. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. While Washington has categorized al-Nusra as a terrorist organization in early 2012, it nonetheless provides support to both al-Nusra and its so-called moderate rebels in the form of weapons, training, logistical support, recruitment, etc. This support is channeled by America's Persian Gulf allies, including Qatar and Saudi Arabia, as well as through Turkey and Israel. And now Russia is being blamed for targeting a terrorist entity which is not only on the UN Security Council blacklist, but which has ties to the Islamic State, ISIS. While the media narrative acknowledges that Russia has endorsed the counterterrorism campaign, in practice, Russia is indirectly fighting the US-NATO coalition by supporting the Syrian government against the terrorists, who happen to be the foot soldiers of the Western military alliance, with Western mercenaries and military advisors within their ranks. The forbidden truth is that by providing military aid to both Syria and Iraq, Russia is indirectly confronting America. That's from the article, Obama Accuses Russia of Going After America's Good Guy Terrorists, by Professor Michelle Chosadovsky, posted October 1st. Media interest in Saudi Arabian connections to the crimes of 9/11 has centered on calls for the release of the 28 missing pages from the Joint Congressional Inquiry's report. However, those calls focus on the question of hijacker financing and omit the most interesting links between the 9/11 attacks and Saudi Arabia, links that implicate powerful people in the United States. Therefore, it is not surprising that people who hear claims of Saudi involvement in 9/11 wonder why the discussion remains so limited and always avoids the glaring implications those claims should entail. Now that the U.S. and Saudi Arabia have reset their rocky relationship, calls by U.S. leaders to release the 28 pages may very well die down. It remains to be seen what cards U.S. and Saudi leaders will play in the ongoing game of terror and deception, but discussions of hijacker financing will probably be left behind. That comes from the article, Why Saudi Ties to 9/11 Mean U.S. Ties to 9/11, by Kevin Ryan, posted September 30th, originally appearing on Kevin Ryan's blog, digwithin.net. Obviously, Putin has self-interest in supporting his allies in Syria and for fighting ISIS. He acknowledged that his country is at risk from some of its own citizens who have sworn an allegiance to that group. Nonetheless, it is important that at least one nation in the world is capable of standing up to American state-sponsored destruction and is willing to take action in that effort. Before the United Nations proceedings took place, Russia announced that it would share intelligence with Iran, Iraq, and Syria in order to combat ISIS. If the United States were true to its word, that alliance would be welcomed instead of scorned. That comes from the article, Putin Trumps Obama at the UN, by Margaret Kimberly, posted September 30th, originally appearing at Black Agenda Report. There are around 64 million empty apartments in China, claims analyst Gillam Tulloch. It's all part of the Chinese government's efforts to keep its economy booming, and there are plenty of people who would love to move in, but the properties are priced out of the market. It's after 2 p.m. and in the new city of Dongguan, shop owner Tian Yugiao is yet to serve a single customer. His open shop is a rare sight in the Great Mall, once heralded by the New York Times as proof of China's astonishing consumer culture. Today, it is an eerie vista of emptiness. That comes from the article, China, Ghost Cities. 64 million empty apartments in China, originally appearing at Journeyman Pictures, posted September 30th. If the political system remains committed to the type of capitalism that exists in Britain today, it will always end up justifying a system that produces a mega-rich and privileged elite. Hence, why Jeremy Corbyn is such a threat to the establishment. Jeremy Corbyn looks like the first senior politician who will not be corrupted by the establishment. He will be the first prime minister, if elected, for decades that does not, and probably will not support the establishment. So frightened of Corbyn, the establishment is now mobilizing their entire resourcefulness at him, evidenced by a threatened military coup, not quite akin to Chile in the 1970s, but an extreme tactic to say the least, one spawned from desperation for sure. That comes from the article, Why the British Establishment Wants Jeremy Corbyn Buried, by Graham Van Bergen, posted September 30th, originally appearing at True Publica. Vitaly Churkin, Russia's permanent representative to the United Nations, said, quote, "The statement was blocked. The Americans said they will not work on our statement," unquote. The talks on the maintenance of international peace and security, settlement of the conflicts in the Middle East and the North of Africa, as well as fight against the terror threat in the region, are the key events under the Russian presidency in the UN Security Council. Assistant Secretary of State for International Organization Affairs, Sheba Crocker, used to claim that the document proposed by Moscow, quote, could be perceived as endorsing an approach that could set back efforts to reach a negotiated political transition in Syria, unquote. From the U.S. point of view, the UN Security Council President's draft statement differs significantly from the Washington's coalition efforts to oppose the Islamic State. That comes from the article, U.S. Blocks Russian Draft on Middle East Conflict Settlement, posted September 30th, originally appearing in Pravda. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. As this episode is being broadcast, a secretive 12-nation trade deal known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, is being negotiated. As was reported by the Global Research News Hour in 2013, chapters of the deal have been revealed to the public via WikiLeaks. These documents have raised concerns about what these nations' governments are signing onto. What is in the TPP and the secrecy surrounding it? And what mechanisms are there for actual democracy? To discuss this, I'm joined in studio by Binoy Campmark. Binoy Campmark was a Commonwealth Scholar at Salmon College, Cambridge, now lecturing at RMIT University in Melbourne. He is a senior lecturer in the School of Global, Urban, and Social Studies. He's teaching within the Bachelor of Social Science program in Legal and Dispute Studies. His research and teaching interests lie in the intersections of law, international relations, and history. Much of his research and teaching involves the examination of conflict, diplomacy, and the various crises confronting international society, including refugees, terrorism, rogue states, and undocumented citizens. Dr. Campmark has written extensively in both refereed journals and more popular media on his research interest topics of the institution of war, diplomacy, international relations, and 20th century history and law. He's been interviewed for National Public Radio in the United States, Radio National in Australia, and radio stations in South Africa. He's also a regular contributor to the online publications, including The Conversation, Eureka Street, Counterpunch, Scoop, and Global Research. He has received numerous awards and accolades, including the Academic Media Star of the Year for public presence, media commentary on day's issues from RMIT University of Melbourne for 4 years running. Binoy holds a PhD in history from the University of Cambridge. He also holds a master's degree in history and honors degrees in arts and law from the University of Queensland. He's a member of the Australian Institute of International Affairs, the American Historical Association, and the British Association for American Studies. Currently, Binoy is finishing a manuscript for publication on the evolution of the rogue state in American political debate. He's also engaged in a project on the origins of neoconservatism in the United States, notably in attitudes to international institutions and law. I'm speaking right now to Dr. Camp Mark on the occasion of his presence here in Winnipeg, where he gave a bit of a presentation on at the Geopolitical Economy Research Group Conference. So, Dr. Camp Mark, it's a pleasure to have you on our program. Thank you for joining us.
It's an absolute pleasure being here.
Okay, so you enjoying Winnipeg so far?
Yes, absolutely. It was, you know, so far what I see is a very impressively located city in terms of history. And, of course, you know, Winnipeg has so many associations with, you know, prairie peasant activism, peasantry, and of course, labor activism too. So the populism of the prairie and the, of course, legacy left by labor strife. And I think this is something that's so interesting, the connections between labor and capital. So I think it's very apt that in many ways the conference that was just concluded reflected a lot about political economic themes, about the role of capitalism and certainly in its historical context and how it affects us now, and where better to have it essentially than Winnipeg, which has been both beneficiary and victim, if you like, of that very ideology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Were there any presentations that stood out for you?
Well, I was struck by – there were a few individual ones, but I was struck by the plenaries. The themes of the plenaries were excellent in the sense that you had a combination of economic valuations of, for example, you know, of capitalism's illnesses, shall we say. You know, the contention that capitalism is somehow reviving now, I think, is a heavily disputed one, and I think there's a lot to suggest.
Exaggerated.
Yes. So you could say that, you know, rumors of its improved health are deeply exaggerated. And it's it was evident, of course, by individuals such as Prabhat Patnaik, of course, very distinguished economist from Jawaharlal Nehru University, who pointed out that that's exactly the problem. And when we look at economic growth figures, for example, such as the United States, which is, of course, the global engine room, we also realize that that growth is essentially in consumer growth. It's not in investment. It's not in capital expenditure. And it's certainly deceptive in terms of matters touching on employment, since there is such a heavily retired employment rate when people just do not go to seek work anymore. The result of it is that whenever we look at actual employment figures behind the, you know, the raw data that's just attained for public consumption, we realize that the problems are very chronic. And the United States is by no means the only society. There are these instances where we have to be careful about reading such figures.
Okay. Now, you, as I mentioned, you did give a presentation of your own, and this had it was based on a paper of yours relating to transparency and I don't know if to call it like kind of a democratization of the that watchdog apparatus. Mm-hmm. And there's some very interesting. You of course brought up the case study of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is starting to get a lot of attention here in Canada finally. Mm-hmm. But I just want you to just sort of get into that idea that, you know, these whistleblower upload sites and mechanisms are introducing a new dynamic that counters the way the more establishment oriented transparency mechanisms, because everybody pays lip service to transparency and we have freedom of information laws and so on. But this, you know, with WikiLeaks and similar such online services, we have this capacity to rethink and remold how we oversee government activities.
Yes, well, you pointed out in that preamble that essentially we are the recipients of information that's heavily controlled by the powers that be. So the doctrine, if you like, or the philosophy of transparency has a long lineage, certainly in Western culture. When we speak about transparency, transparent mechanisms, for example, such as freedom of information, go back to the, you know, the 18th century. And when it comes to that, whistleblower protections, in fact, go back to the 18th century too, an example being acts that were passed by the Continental Congress, in fact, to allow whistleblowing in the context, for example, of reporting, and this is very relevant when I think about Chelsea Manning, in the context of reporting atrocities and and abuses and so forth. But the reality of it is that establishment transparency, if you want to call it that, ultimately deems the public to, you know, be a recipient in their interest, but it also deems it in their interest not to provide information, as it were, if the circumstances arise. So time and time again, what we tend to see is in FOI requests, Freedom of Information requests, we get back redacted documents. We get back a document that's useless. You know, most of the names are removed, most of the materials removed. The context is simply not there. And this is down to this irritable idea that somehow government needs protection from, dare I say it, us, from the public, rather than the government then trying to be true to its word, which is the idea that public information, or the information, if you like, is a public resource. This is an expression that you'll see quite often used, information is a public resource. But government authorities, agencies, and entities often use, interestingly enough, the release of information to control it. So FOI, and call it FOI declassification and regimes of information like that, are actually there to control rather than release information. It's not nothing to do, in a sense, about being an open government. It's got to do with being a controlled government, if you like, a controlled information space.
I think people usually think of it in terms of democracy, and, well, this is something that we foisted on our overseers, like a kind of check and balance that you've got to have transparency. But they've twisted that in such a way as so that it's not really a response to a need in a democratic society for full transparency.
Well, yes, it's this, and I'm not suggesting at all that there is no place for having certain functions of government, of course, that need to be, you know, kept, as it were, in the shadows. I'm not for a minute suggesting that, but I am suggesting that a huge function of government has been concealed by the nature of this information regime. And the democratic argument has been slanted, deeply slanted, because it doesn't actually presume that a citizen should be totally informed. And I think it's important to understand in political theory and certainly in practice that if we are to be governed, as it were, by the consent, that we give our consent to the leaders of the day, to governments of the day, we also have to understand that that consent should come not in an unqualified way, but in a manner that is informed. And that information is fundamental. No knowledge of policies, for example, knowledge about what the government is doing in its foreign theater, knowledge about, for example, the implications of vital treaties or covenants or agreements, such as the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which you touched upon earlier, and which was certainly a fundamental feature about what I was discussing at the Global Economy Conference. And this is the fundamental point that individuals, if they're not informed about this, are essentially estranged entities. They're just political units on a voting sheet. They don't really have any participation role. They become less subjects, or they become rather just subjects rather than true citizens. And that's been my argument for a long time along those lines.
And I think we're going to touch on Trans-Pacific Partnership in just a second, but I wanted you to talk about your involvement with WikiLeaks, because I think it bears a lot of significance in terms of this discussion.
Well, yes, certainly. The involvement has been for some years now an interest in their activities, which I suppose some would call it. I don't necessarily think of it as that as radical, but it is perceived to be what's called radical transparency, or vigilante transparency, or you know, and so forth. So there are a range of images, metaphors that have been used to describe what Julian Assange is doing, and certainly in the context of the WikiLeaks organization. But what is, you know, what is fascinating about it, and that's where my involvement comes in, is that my feeling about it, and certainly how I've tried to articulate it over certainly the last 3 years or so, has been to make it aware that actually the project WikiLeaks is pursuing is in some ways a very standard, even orthodox one, which is that people should know. It goes back to the original context, if you like, of democracy, what it should be. You know, Jefferson himself talks extensively about, for example, the role of an informed free press, and that essentially, you know, government should be composite, an element that needs to involve media and the free press and so forth. And I do see that the role of WikiLeaks is a purified version of that, essentially getting down to the going even further than, for example, a newspaper that discusses source material. It goes to the next step. It actually allows the public to see the source material so that there is no middle mediation role, if you like. Because the problem, of course, is, and it has been said time and time again, a newspaper, if you want to involve yourself or meet a self-censoring mechanism, go to a newspaper. Because a newspaper itself, by its inherent nature, be it through the editor, the sub-editor, sub-sub-editor, and so forth, by the time the paper publishes a piece, it's gone through a bit of skimming and trimming and God knows what else. So the mechanism, you know, of censorship, if you like, is still very much evident in the newspapers. And that's leaving aside, you know, the political philosophies associated with publication and what that entails and the corporate media and all of that. The reality is that you do not necessarily get to see the original source. And I think it's important to note, too, that WikiLeaks, in that connection, by virtue of allowing that source material to be seen on its site, has also transformed the way journalism is done, because you see very often now on newspapers, for example, you will see that on the Guardian website, on Washington Post, you will see that the actual original document is there for perusal, that they will discuss it, the particular journalist in question will examine it, but the actual document is also there if you want to go to, for example, you know, say a released a document describing drone strikes in Waziristan, and that whole document will be made available. And that is a transformation that's taken place only in the last few years, and that's a very striking and a very interesting one as well.
You know, since you just raised the point, I mean, I'm a journalist, albeit a citizen journalist, and I certainly have understood that, or my impressions are that, I mean, everything that you're saying about, you know, easier access to that raw data is very significant. But one of the things that the journalist does is provide context. And it kind of makes me wonder about could there be a downside to this whole business? I mean, we keep hearing, like, we hear about just in a broader framework the how, you know, people read blogs that are anonymous or have no, you know, who don't source or do their attributions properly, and that can become a major influence on the body politics. Do you see any downsides to this?
Invariably, I think a parallel to draw out here, which can shed light, I think, on your question, is the role of, for example, Wikipedia. Now, when Wikipedia started, of course, there was a considerable amount of criticism, as there still is in some circles. I know that I myself, being an academic, I always tell my students when they use Wikipedia, I do not like to see them in the reference list, Wikipedia entries, but I always tell them by all means use it as a platform initially to get more reading done and to read widely as much as possible, because after all, in the space of information, there's a lot of beavering to do.
Double check those
footnotes.
Yes,
exactly. And the reality is that that's what we also have with information that's released from sites such as WikiLeaks. And the onus is still on the person to conduct an investigation to value the merit of the source. And WikiLeaks has never hidden from the fact that the material is provided from sources that have, of course, been provided to them by others. The reality of it is that the response from the reading public, if you like, will always vary depending on what context it is. I'm certainly not one of those, shall we say, all faithful followers of the credo that just because people have information that they're going to dramatically become more enlightened. People's response may be different. And if anything, in some cases, having the information there can also propel people into a state of denial, people have very interesting members of the public and so on, or whatever fraternity it might be. The reality is that people have sophisticated mechanisms of filtering out what they don't want to see. That's the nature of information. You know, you don't necessarily want to see some information, so you try to pattern it into a preconceived notion, a prejudice, and so forth, which brings us back to what some, for example, the strategies of editorial boards such as The Sun, Rupert Murdoch's papers, and so forth. They already anticipate what the audience wants, so they feed them accordingly. But sometimes readers will anticipate that that's how the material is slanted. So the question of this objective reader, of course, is never going to be found. This idealized objective reader simply does not exist, nor perhaps do we want that objective reader to exist. The idea, rather, is to get a full swathe of information, of which scientific journalism, or forensic scientific journalism, as Assange likes to call it, is an example of this. So ideally speaking, of course, on a daily basis, you know, we should be spending perhaps more time than we normally do on trying to sense, for example, what is the Russian view on this crisis? What is the US view, the Canadian view? What is the German view? And that would give us a better perspective. But the reality still remains that the more original information in that sense, the merrier. Context doesn't disappear. Journalism has a very important role. It's just the more refined it is, the better it gets, I think.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Well, maybe I should get you to just give a bit of a backgrounder, if you could, about this agreement and what might be offensive about it from a Canadian perspective.
Yes, well, I think the first thing to note about the Trans-Pacific Partnership is that if you want to see, its genesis, if you like, and how it's come about, it's rooted in the notion of free trade doctrine, which of course by its very nature is unfree. The whole context of free trade is that it's distinctly filled with controls, limitations, and is only free for the powerful, if you want to put it that way. It has a very similar basis to free trade agreements, a plethora of free trade agreements that have been made between countries. The United States has been at the forefront, of course, of making free trade agreements with countries such as Australia. It's tried to do so with China. It's been, trying to do so with Japan. It's been doing a range of free trade agreements, which, of course, essentially is meant to allow greater access for domestic products. So the product that is produced in one country is meant to be then made freely available in the other country. And then supposedly there's meant to be a reciprocal basis that an aspect of our market is then opened up for their products and so on. Okay, well, that's the principle of it. The actual practice of it is often and has been disastrous. The example of the US-Australia Free Trade Agreement has shown by studies done by the Crawford Business School at the Australian National University that an agreement that was meant to produce, and I'm trying to remember the figures off the top of my head, but say roughly sort of say 13 billion has ended up costing 50 billion. Which is staggering. So the actual result of a lot of these free trade agreements is you might even call them a form of vassalage that happens with the weaker state, where the weaker state actually ends up having a subordinate market to the bigger, country in question. And that brings us to what the Trans-Pacific Partnership is all about. It has been called NAFTA on steroids. It has been deemed to be an agreement which will incorporate the 12 countries of the Asia-Pacific Rim, but it's also offensively directed against China because it's very clear, and this is where the not-so-free element comes into it as well. It seems to be designed to allow and consolidate a U.S. role in the Asia-Pacific. It's part of the Obama pivot, if you like, part of the rebalancing and terms used like that. The Obama administration has made it very clear that this is part of their economic strategy in terms of dealing with the Asia-Pacific, which it sees, of course, as the growth hub in the next 20 to 30 years. And for that reason, this agreement is being made to, as it were, steal a march and hope to consolidate U.S. power for the next generation, if you like. So that brings us, of course, then to, well, what does it actually do? And this is where it's very problematic. First of all, it's being negotiated in secret. And what it strikes me as remarkable is that the very premise that it's being negotiated in secret is not really counted very much by even many, dare I say it, in the journalistic fold. It's almost as if there is an understanding that they're perfectly entitled to do this. Now, I would not myself necessarily object to it if I wasn't so suspicious about what government activities entail. And knowing enough about government activities, you know, I can tell you that when they say that it will be good for you, it's probably not going to be good for you. I mean, the whole point about it is to be critical about the material. And to say that a particular a huge document with such sweeping implications for pharmaceuticals, for healthcare, generic drugs, manufacture of generic drugs, for IP, intellectual property, the use of the internet, for example, the environmental protections, implications like that. And I'm just touching on a few of those items. Surely the public is entitled to have some access to at least the proviso of where the countries stand on provisions within it and release some sort of draft working copy and so forth. And, of course, this has not happened, except via the release of certain chapters via WikiLeaks. You know, the IP chapter, the intellectual property chapters, very interesting and grim reading. And the environmental chapter is grim reading, and a ministerial document talking about competition is grim reading. They all suggest, essentially, the U.S.-driven trade agenda and where the other countries essentially fit in this. And this trade agenda is being driven using defunct pieces of legislation that even Congress rejected. So Stop Online Piracy Act, for example, is an example of one of those things.
Where it relates to internet service providers.
Exactly. It relates to the role that ISPs are going to be performing in the context of material that supposedly violates copyright and the power given to corporations to sue or to target ISPs, effectively make ISPs take down that offending material, effectively acting as a form of censorship on the net, so that that material can be removed down from the net, taken down from it, which is a rather alarming situation.
So is that something that takes place? I mean, if you have that ability to sue an ISP for releasing copyrighted material, how is that process? Is it through a tribunal of some sort or what?
Well, this is what's not clear, and this is where we have still the documents that were available through WikiLeaks that talk about the fact that the pressure will be put on the ISP by the relative corporation. There may be penalties. It's not clear, but it's suggested by the documents in discussion points that there may be penalties arising from it. In terms of tribunals, it's not clear. It's probably going to be a domestic matter that will be then retained by each of the states, depending on what they want to do. But again, it's not clear whether there's going to be a trans-Pacific partnership tribunal on the subject. I just don't see that happening. I see that actually a lot of problems arising from the mechanics, the mechanical aspect of it. But I also see fundamental problems because it will put a strain on ISPs to become the watchdogs. So effectively what the ISPs are going to do, and this will be the response, is they're going to establish mechanisms themselves to deal with taking down material. And that is the disconcerting aspect of it, because effectively it'll encourage that extra barrier of censorship. Because they'll be afraid about the financial implications.
If we don't take this down, we could be sued.
Exactly, exactly. So that's the kind of chilling effect that this kind of measure will have.
Yes, and we didn't find out anything about that except through WikiLeaks.
Yes, exactly.
And,
yeah.
What about the – you mentioned also another chapter that came through WikiLeaks, the environmental chapter. What was in there that we really need to pay attention to?
Well, the problems that – of course, they're specific to the states, to each of the states and parties negotiating this. If, for example, the states may have country or the participant country may have fisheries, for example, the question then is to what extent can they sustain it? Will they be affected by the agreements? The particular tendency here seems to be that countries such as the United States have eased off on the environmental chapter, by allowing countries to focus more greatly, for example, on environmentally degrading practices. So they're not going to go ham and tongs over the issue of degrading practices, for example, you know, be it in Malaysia or, you know, be it in Vietnam and so forth. There's going to be latitude about that. There is a concession that each country is allowed to pursue its own environmental practices. But if you look carefully at the chapters available there, the provisions and the articles of the draft chapter, the emphasis there is actually on the corporate element, not the environmental element. Everything can be done to protect the environment as long as it doesn't clash with the corporate ideals. So I'm just imagining logging companies, you know, lightening up to this and getting rather thrilled. I'm just imagining how certain practices, be it emissions, be it, of course, the fossil fuel lobby, could possibly be rather thrilled with this. So the TPP acts as a, you know, as a favorable mechanism for the corporate sector, but an unfavorable one for the environmental sector, even though there are some throwaway articles that favor a balance between trade and environment. But the reality is that such provisions have not necessarily been successful before and tend to be undervalued in the context of trade agreements.
I remember back in the just a few years ago, there was a sort of a harmonization of Canada, the United States, and Mexico being negotiated, called the Security and Prosperity Partnership. And they were having these secret meetings, which had government ministers meeting with corporate individuals. And a lot of the criticism is that, again, it was secret, but you know, like, where are the labor unions? Where are the environmentalists and other social activists? I mean, it seemed as if you have these corporations that seem to have preferred access on legislation that will have an impact on many more people. So yeah, I mean, this TPP. I mean, I don't know how familiar you are with that SPP business.
No, certainly, I am. I think the point there, and this is a very stark example of it, that's drawn to demonstrate how almost contemptuous governments have become about the voting public. Precisely because the paternalism creeps in all the time. We know best. And how do we know best? We know best because we have the right ideology for the right moment. And the right ideology of the moment is, of course, this, you know, forms of neoliberalism and so forth, where the actual corporation is a far more worthy legal person than a human being, where the corporation itself is meant to be a driver of wealth. And, of course, the reality is, depending on how assets are used and how investments works, that a corporation is for itself. It's got nothing. The notion of social welfare, the notion of you know, the notion of rights and privileges, or the notion of obligations, simply does not exist there. I mean, a corporation does not have a vote, and yet a corporation has a disproportionate share of dictating the economic agenda. So the paradox is that the person who votes at an election may have rights to vote, but the corporation, even though BHP Billiton, for example, may not have a vote, may not, as a person, vote at an election, they can dictate that particular electoral agenda. They can dictate what energy policy might exist. They can be influential in what provisions might be valid or important in the context of a trade treaty. The same thing goes for the giants of technology. They can be, they're the ones who are consulted. They're the ones who are consulted about how an enormous mechanism such as the internet functions. Whereas publics, you know, citizen or groups, unions, you were saying labor unions, NGOs, all of these groups are completely left out of the cold, as it were, to anticipate what will come. But we can already see that the very presumption that a corporation will have a space at the negotiating table is itself very problematic. And I think it says a lot about the hollowing out of political representation and the role of a valid political representation if we're going to have such forms of negotiation taking place without scrutiny.
But you see, I mean, it's obviously not an official device, but WikiLeaks and Anonymous and these sorts of you know, grassroots online oriented mechanisms provide some, you know, a de facto check and balance on these secretive deals. So secret that I believe that even, you know, members of parliament, or whether it's in Canada, Australia, or anywhere else, that get a chance to see it, they're sworn to secrecy, right?
Yes, they certainly are. If you look at the documents that have been made available, each one of them has confidential, which is to be expected. But the issue is not just that; it's the next stage of the. Certainly, this was released in a ministerial document in discussions that took place in Singapore a few years ago. Available via the WikiLeaks website. And the particular document issues a range of, or in almost threatening language, that each one of the member states cannot discuss this with their respective citizens. They cannot reveal this in public. They cannot discuss the provisions in public. It's remarkable. It actually suggests from the start that they are to have no interaction as citizens, as, you know, political figures that are to have no interaction, in other words, not to perform their job in the context of dealing with the TPP. That really is, so for example, to mention the case in Australia, the same thing in DC, Washington. Members of Congress can go and read the document, but they can't discuss it. So they can actually see it, but they can't mention it. They can't even mention they've seen it. This is how perverse it is. So they can look at it, but they can't mention they've seen it. And I don't necessarily hold, and whereas I don't want to be entirely cynical about members of Congress, but I know that their reading record is rather confused in terms of passing large chunks of legislation. You know, I always remember how the Patriot Act was dealt with and how the large majority of Congress men and women never read it. They just assumed that it was appropriate at the time to have such a broad-ranging police state measure to combat, of course, the threat of terrorism. So the issue is, in this particular case, and that's something that Senator Elizabeth Warren said, you know, if you don't want to discuss this or allow us to discuss this with the public, then there's probably something quite grave you want to hide. And that's, of course, the big implication about this kind of behavior.
Yeah, of course. In the United States, they have this fast-track legislation, which essentially shuts out debate.
Yes, the fast track is an interesting mechanism, and it brings to mind an encounter which you know, I'm happy to share with you and the audience. And that took place 2 years ago when a visiting delegate from the Center for International Strategic Studies based in Washington, D.C. And like many think tanks in D.C., of course, the association is stacked with former trade officials or individuals who have had their finger in the expansive pie of power, trade, economic, military, and so forth. So the center is no exception. So one of the delegates who had been involved in the Clinton trade policy, had been one of the advisors on Clinton, for President Clinton's trade policies. So he came and gave a presentation about the TPP. Now, in question time, and this was in Melbourne, so this was actually at the business school at RMIT University where I'm, you know, where I lecture. So the contents went a bit like this. He gave a description. It was very bland. It was, of course, grand. Everything is grand about the TPP. Superb figures I mentioned, plucked out of the air. GDP figures, projected figures, wealth, and thank goodness Australia's on our side because we'll go strong. And it was an extraordinary presentation without substance. It was a presentation that had absolutely nothing to do with the implications of the TPP, but what was supposedly meant to be the grand project about what it entailed. So once the rosiness had settled down a bit and question time arrived, I decided to ask him directly whether he had actually read the TPP. He said, no, he hadn't. And that's just to give you an idea about how this works. The assumption is that it's good, so let's not read it. We just know it's going to be dandy.
Well, it's certainly the case here in Canada. Yeah. Like, I look at the mainstream media coverage, and it's generally seen, well, you know, free, it's taken as an axiom that free trade is going to be good, and so how are the partisan all the different partisans aligning themselves with that.
Yes, I've been struck by that too. It's a very similar position in countries associated with the negotiations, that there is, that it's almost like a consensus that's developed, a central consensus that one, free trade is dandy, absolutely fabulous stuff, you know, all for that. And but the second thing is that it's assumed, irrespective of what the provisions are, that it's going to be good. So you see that, I noticed that actually in the discussions, to a large extent, the discussions in Canada, and I've certainly noticed that in the Australian context and in other countries, Malaysia, for example, where it's just taken as a given, that it's going to be a good thing.
Mm-hmm. What about the people? I mean, like I haven't seen much in the way of popular reaction here in Canada, but what about out in Australia and New Zealand? Is there more awareness out there?
Well, in August, in August this year, there were actually protests in 21 New Zealand cities on the very subject. New Zealand's an interesting case because, judging from the documentation that is available for perusal, and I do encourage, you know, your listeners to go to the site to actually see the documentation on WikiLeaks. The suggestion seems to be that New Zealand's actually quite aggressive on negotiating on certain fronts. So, for example, they're very insistent on accessing the U.S. Dairy market, and that's a very big thing. That's part of the same thing with the Australians, although the Australians are by only, I would say, just a shadow of a negotiating team relative to the New Zealanders on this point. And filtering down from that and made available because of the documents is also a groundswell of suspicion about the implications of the document, because New Zealand's a small economy, country of 3 million people. And it has also been at the forefront of economic experiments, which have been very harmful to it. In the 80s, it was right at the front of the neoliberal project. It was pioneering, in fact, in so many ways, privatization, for example, and opening up the market to the forces of the corporate sector. So those protests were not negligible. Certainly the protests in Auckland and in Wellington, in Christchurch, we're talking about thousands of people actually protesting. So there is a presence, there is a genuine foot presence, if you like, and there is a very strong media, social media presence about the concerns of the TPP. Of course, the problem is it doesn't, and that's again the problem, that divide between the vox pops, if you like, and the, you know, the popular sentiment, and then the government dictates. Mm. Ultimately, the strategy tends to be, I've noticed that Prime Minister Harper does this quite a lot. It is, well, we did our best. I mean, we did our best at the negotiating table, but in the end, we have to make this concession, as it were. And this is what tends to happen, and it's been happening with TPP negotiations. The message is being sold differently depending on the audience. If the audience is a concerned one, then the audience has to be told, one, trade is good, but two, we're going to fight for certain things. We're going to fight, for example,
supply management.
Yes, exactly. We're going to hollow out, for example, the big thing in Canada now is the dairy industry, of course, and what will happen in the context of the TPP.
And they've sworn that they're going to protect supply management.
And that's exactly why you need to be worried, yes.
Oh.
Now, yes. The moment a politician says they will swear to protect it, you might as well give up the ghost on that. You know, an admission to protect. But remember, that's what they should be doing. They shouldn't even have to say that. And this is the worry for me. The moment they have to articulate, oh, we're protecting you, then obviously they're not. Obviously their interest will be elsewhere, even though, you know, in their own perception, they may well be thinking that. But it's political choreography. The moment an individual says in Parliament or as a representative, that I swear I will defend this, they obviously are going to surrender.
Yeah, because I mean, if it's non-negotiable, then why are you negotiating?
Yes, exactly. The whole point is that it should not be negotiable. Yeah. The whole point is that protecting certain core industries, and this is the rhetoric that's so self-defeatingly contortionist. You've got, members of the dairy board saying, "I would never imagine that this could possibly happen. Surely, no Canadian government could possibly let the dairy industry suffer this catastrophe." But that's exactly the very fact that it's being discussed suggests that the avenue is available.
Okay. Now, how does – I mean, this partnership involves 12 countries, the Pacific Rim countries. How does TPP, you know, interface with other trade agreements worldwide?
Well, as Assange has said, the TPP essentially is the icebreaker for global corporate interweaving, if you like, of a U.S.-led styled corporate – call it a revolution. It may sound dramatic, but it's not perhaps that dramatic because it's been incrementally developed over the last 20 years, the interlocking trade agreements with numerous countries. And what the TPP does is that's the prelude to, for example, negotiations taking place with the services agreement, which is a very important one that will regulate. That's a trade and services agreement, which is another document.
TISA?
Yes, that's right. Yes, exactly. And then there is the investment agreement, which is connecting the EU and the United States. So you can see the strategic dimension here, that on the one hand, the agreement in the Asia Pacific is directed against China to a large extent, and certain extent the Latin American context to Brazil and so on, and then to, you know, towards Europe, the EU, it's directed against, for example, powers such as Russia and so forth, and countries that could pose possible risk to the perceived economic hegemony of the United States. So essentially, there is a platform of agreements that, if implemented, will, I suppose, you could say, consolidate U.S. power for the next half century. I mean, that's effectively what the idea is. So I think notions about the emerging economies and notions that, you know, Russia and China and Brazil and India are providing some form of either a bulwark or a counter, I think misguided. I think one of the things that has been mentioned, and he gave a paper at the conference to Andrew Fisher, is that notions of a serious counter to U.S. power are perhaps exaggerated themselves. It may well be that the emergence of these powers is being managed. It's being accommodated in the U.S. platform of power. And all these agreements that we're talking about, the investment agreements, TISA, the TPP, all of these are projected towards managing the growth of the other countries involved, whilst controlling the negotiating partners as well, whilst effectively making sure that their markets are available for U.S. products.
Mm, so TPP restricts China, and the transatlantic agreement restricts Russia.
Yes, it's you can see it if you look at the map, how it's directed against respective forces. And it's no accident. This is certainly, of course, is never going to be mentioned openly by a State Department official that is directed against Russia or it's directed against China. But it is the very fact that they're nowhere to be seen in the negotiating tables on this is a striking fact and point. If they wanted to be genuine about free trade, surely they would incorporate China into the mix of Asia-Pacific countries. But they're not. They've taken a clear stance against the emergence of China, against the, you know, let's look at some of the implications of the TPP itself, the IP provisions, the internet, the copyright provisions, and so forth. China is considered a great threat when it comes to technology, adaptation, and the use of material, the use of IP, and then the constant suggestion, even in the U.S. political classes, is that the Chinese are, you know, compulsive appropriators and hackers of U.S. intellectual copyright. So the TPP tends to be one of those mechanisms that tries to control those sort of instances so that Chinese products can be dealt with as well within the zone, if you like.
Mm. I was thinking as you were speaking earlier that this is kind of like a Trojan horse or like a U.S.-NATO-skewed WTO by stealth, but you make it sound as if it's more like a quasi-military strategy.
Well, it's sort of certainly it's a coordinated economic strategy that has a certain military flavor about it. It's an economic war of sorts, if you like, and that's what you essentially see happening on a daily basis. The whole issue about where the dealing with patents, dealing with copyright, generally speaking, is a battleground. And it's a battleground that's fought in courts. It's a battleground that's fought between government officials. It's a battleground that's, fought in the broadest sense of things, which have severe implications about the way we interact with each other, with citizens, our fellow citizens, but also the way we interact with government and agencies connected with that.
On that note, grim or otherwise, I think we'll probably bring our conversation to a close, at least for the time being. I got to say, it's been great meeting you in person and having this conversation. It's been delighted to have you in CKUW here.
Oh, likewise. Absolute pleasure being with you and the audience here today, Michael. Thank you.
Okay. Been speaking with Binoy Kapmark, and he's joining us here on the Global Research News Hour here at CKUW. Binoy Kapmark was a Commonwealth Scholar at Selwyn College, Cambridge. He currently lectures at RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.